We hope you enjoy your stay. It's good to have you with us, even if it's just for the day. We hope you enjoy your stay. Outside the sun is shining, it seems like heaven ain't far away. It's good to have you with us, even if it's just for the day.
Welcome to the 2013 We Talk Comics Super Summit. My name is Mo Christensen. I'll be your moderator for the event. I have with me here Brett Monroe, the co-founder of We Talk Podcast. And from here, we're going to go around the room, starting on our left here. Everybody introduce themselves.
So I'm you can Brett, all co-host of We Talk Comics.
That's you, Nick.
No leg story stuff.
You can tell whatever you want. Please introduce yourself. Tell everybody what you're here
Chris
for.
Chris has just done everything interesting about himself.
My name is Nick Johnson. I was working on a webcomic called Wolf Hands, and I've done a little bit of layout and color work. I'm currently doing colors for Go Getters with Sean Aldred and Chris Peterson. And I guess that's it for now. Pow!
I'm Ryan Ferrier, and I'm a writer and letterer, and I have a book called Dave with Monkey Brain, and I self-publish Tiger Lawyer and Brother James.
What's Tiger Lawyer about? I hear it's about a tiger who's a damn lawyer. Yeah. Is that correct?
That is an apt.
Yeah. Is it awesome? Just so you got the line.
You spoiler alert, dude.
Chris.
I'm Chris Peterson. I draw comics, and just lately did the Grindhouse comics, just one and two, and working on Go Getters right now, and a bunch of other random things coming out next year. I don't know what else to say.
That's fine, thanks.
It's me.
It is.
I need entrance music, which everybody should know that by now.
I thought that was actually only for Anima Bag Show.
No, that's Scott Kowalczyk's entrance theme now. So yeah, Scott Kowalczyk. I'm talking to the microphone and not you guys. So I did Intrepids at Image Comics, the recently canceled Strangers at Oni Press. Thank you. Gasps. And in February, my OGN from Oni Press, Downset Fight, will be released. And literally 2 minutes ago, 30 minutes ago, I sent in my contract for my new book. So
nice.
It's okay, everybody.
Good news.
That's happy.
My name is Riley. I draw books for Image and some other folks.
that was as good as Chris's introduction, not just the hair batter.
I'm Jason Memel. I write and publish Fight Comics. I've got Volume 1 out and Volume 2 on the way. I've got some other stuff in the fire, but nothing else to announce.
I'm Keith. I'm one of the co-hosts of We Talk Comics. And I purchase all of the comics that have been mentioned so far. And tell strangers on the street how great Dave is. Because it's the latest great comic to come out of Calgary.
I still can't pronounce four, though.
We just did it.
Dave with a four in it. That's not Dave.
No, the title is actually D4VE.
DeForb.
DeForb. It says so on the inside cover.
Oh. Way to
thank you.
I'm serious in here.
It doesn't say that.
Also, there's no cover.
Yeah. My name's Ben. I'm an aspirant comic maker. I guess I'm actually making stuff now, so that's good. Nothing I can actually talk about for the moment, so there you go.
a lot of mystery going on here at this table. All right, we have three topics, two that we'll definitely get to and one that will be time permitting. The first topic, I'm going to get Keith to introduce it for us.
Which topic's that?
Emotionally subnormal, Keith. And go.
All right. So every once in a while, someone asks Alan more about comics, and unfortunately, he still answers. this was an interview in The Guardian in November. I'm trying to find a good entry point here. I haven't read superhero comics since I finished The Watchmen. I hate superheroes. I think they're abominations. They don't mean what they used to mean. They were originally in the hands of writers who would actively expand the imagination of their 9 to 13-year-old audience. That was completely what they were meant to do, and they were doing it excellently. These days, superhero comics think the audience is certainly not 9 to 13. It's got nothing to do with them. It's an audience of 30, 40, 50, 60-year-old men, usually men. Someone came up with the term graphic novel. These readers latched onto it. They were simply interested in a way that could validate their continued love of Green Lantern or Spider-Man without appearing in some way emotionally subnormal. This is a significant rump of the superhero addicted mainstream addicted audience.
Did he really use the word rump?
Rump.
Good. Yep. Good.
Yeah. I need to bring rump back.
I don't think the superhero stands for anything good. I think it's a rather alarming sign if we've got audiences of adults going to see the Avengers movie and delighting in concepts and characters meant to entertain the 12-year-old boys of the 1950s.
How can you not like that?
I think Ben has something to say.
I'm just like, yeah, I guess so.
Nailed it again. Follow Ben on Twitter, because it's always like that.
Started to not use punctuation, too. It's my new thing.
You notice he said that without a period. It's
just kidding. Just bring Spider-Man jammies right now.
I love Alan Moore, and I especially love when Alan Moore says anything. But he, to play devil's advocate, most of these superhero comics that he's talking about that older people are reading, they don't seem to be made for younger people to read. That's all.
I actually found what Alan Moore said to be just a teensy bit hypocritical, considering he took Steve Ditko's Charlton characters and turned them into something much more graphic and adult, where they were very pure in that sort of, that 9 to 12-year-old, audience form, the question Blue Beetle. And then to do what he did with the Joker, making him very gritty and kind of gross. It was the byproduct of comics now can be really, traced back to what he and Miller did in the mid-80s.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thank you. I totally agree. I feel like a lot of what he's saying now, I feel the Alan Moore of today is almost like Alan Moore the performance artist, mm-hmm. That there's an element of intentional satire. He's talked about that, comic book industry are going through his rubbish like raccoons in the night to try to find new stories. And he doesn't actually believe that Bendis is in his backyard going through his garbage. But I think the flip side is that DC will put a story, a couple of years ago there was that Green Lantern run that basically it launched off of an idea that Alan Moore put in a 5-page Green Lantern story in 83. I think it's one of those things where I think his satirical point goes so far as to provoke the conversation, but I think the flip side is that people they're only reacting against him. They're not kind of going, at what point is that uncomfortably close, and that's kind of where I come from. I think and anyone else can interrupt at any point here, but.
No, you're talking for the rest of the podcast.
We can do it, dude.
Ben got me drugged.
No, it doesn't sound good.
I just think that people are pulling some stuff out of there and focusing on that. Okay, so since The Watchmen, everything's been in that Dark Knight Can we swear on this, or is this
French? Say whatever you want. Feel free.
Just like, you know, oh, superheroes like rape people and they like, fuck each other in the ass and like everything's so like dark and gritty. So I mean, I get some of that. It's like the only way to have a punctuation mark on an event or whatever is to kill somebody. Who can we kill and who can we have? Oh, Gwen Stacy had sex with Norman Osborn. Like, is that good writing? I don't know. Maybe, right? So I think there is some, like, maybe you're not writing for, like, 9 to 14-year-olds, right? But, like, Daredevil right now. Mark Waid's Daredevil?
Yeah.
It's just good.
It's great.
You don't need to, nobody has to have sex with anybody on camera. You can just imply relationships. Matt's really charming. And it's just good stories. There's no thing. And I think, to me, that's what I get out of more saying crazy shit like that. It's just saying... They don't have to be so stupid. And it is crazy because he made them as stupid, right?
Yeah.
But then it's not a parody anymore. It's not commenting on anything anymore. It's just...
Mm-hmm. It became the
status quo,
like,
right?
The canon for the what paradigm, comic books are.
Yeah.
Right,
like,
well, that's the big thing. When Alan Moore started doing this, it was intentionally commenting on the superhero. And that, like, so Watchmen wasn't intended to be... like to upgrade the genre, it was intended to comment on it, and in some cases maybe close it.
Yeah.
The stuff we're seeing about the next big DC event, Future's End, looks a lot like Alan Moore's Twilight of the Gods, which was intended to be the ending of superheroes. He in the 80s, around the Watchmen time, he came up with a crossover event idea called Twilight of the Gods, and it would have set a 20 years in the future of DC Universe, here's the status quo, and then tell all the writers, build to that. That is a fixed point. Mm. And you would transition out the characters.
Like Age of Apocalypse for DC, essentially.
Yeah, and then you would actually... Yeah, Days of Future Past for X-Men.
Right.
And,
right.
And in some ways, the way that 1 year later was. But you would actually set a fixed point and move toward it and retire these characters. And it was very bold. And of course they didn't do it. It was interesting. I saw so much of the reaction. I had my own reaction to what Moore said at the time. And then about a month later, I read the newest X-Men event, Battle of the Atom. And I got to then the end of that, and all I could think was, it's fucking right. Like, what did I just read? I read 10 issues of the X-Men fighting each other, and then they... played a game of Red Rover at the end and moved four characters from one team to the other. Nothing else happened. All that this was about was shuffling the deck again.
And that's
sorry. Please go.
The thing that's kind of, I feel like superheroes is always like, it has to be the next big thing. It has to be reshuffling of the deck, the killing of the characters, instead of just telling a story, right? Like Hawkeye? Awesome. What? Just tell a story. Daredevil? Same thing. And like at DC, everyone was, I feel like a lot of people were disappointed when Snyder left Swamp Thing. I really like it. We get like Souls writing like two-issue stories. Swamp Thing fights this guy, and he fights this guy. Or Swamp Thing has a crisis, and then he solves it 2 issues later. It's fun. You don't need to, like, it doesn't have to be this world rewriting, reinvention process every time, right? You just get a story, you can pick it up, it's good. You don't need continuity, you don't need to do... Like, I buy Chris Bacchello X-Men.
Mm-hmm.
I just get that one, right? I get the middle of the battle for the Atom. I don't even know who the characters are. I'm like, I buy this book every month, I'm looking at it, I'm like, I don't know anybody.
Riley, your books that you do yourself, though, aren't traditional superhero books. I think it's actually interesting to hear your point of view on these characters.
Well, I love superheroes. Maybe I'm emotionally retarded. But the stuff I kind of like too, though, was like Iron Fist, right? Like, I love the Iron Fist run, like, all through the faction stuff, and then the Dwayne Wazinski or whatever his name is. Because you read that book and you're in that world, and it's fun, and he's fighting for justice. And there are all these things that are cool about superheroes. And I know what's going on. I don't need to buy anything else.
All those are a form of entertainment, right? Yeah. Ben, you had something more to say?
No, Ryan, please.
I agree with Riley very much. I think he articulated that very well. I think that Keith, you had mentioned like Alan Moore's his end of the superhero kind of thing. I think that The Boys kind of tried to do that, but it was too much.
Excuse me.
Pee-pee poo-poo.
There's too much pee-pee poo-poo. But then there is Josh Fialkov's, I think it was Last of the Greats. Did you guys read that one?
Yeah.
His Image book. And it was just, like, amazing. It has this, like, I'm just spoiling for it. It has this great scene where the superhero is, like, the god, and he's the one superhero, and he's in front of all the people, and he's doing his, like, I'll take care of you, and, like, I'll protect you, and he picks up a baby, and he says, like, this is an orphan baby, and I will take it and raise it as my own. And then there's this beautiful page where you see the superhero flying over, like, the river, or the ocean, and then you just see the baby drop in the ocean. I saw that, like, that's the perfect ending to, if they never wrote any superhero books, like, it's horrible. But, yeah, I love great stuff, like the new, like, Charles Sewell Swamp Thing and Devil, just because they're just great, fun books.
One feeling like I've had lately, I've sort of been batting this theory around, that superhero comics and comics in general, for a long time were kind of going on a strictly go-forward basis. Like, every issue was a new villain, a new thing happening. It was always a new development. And, like, in the old Supermans, like, there was those, we've seen those, like, blogs where they'll show all these, like, hundreds of wacky Superman covers, like,
Super Dickory.
Super Dickory, yeah, exactly. We're like, why is Superman marrying Batman? It's, yeah. We're just weird stuff. But at some point...
That happened.
On the cover.
Oh. Yeah, it's always on the cover.
It's just
far removed from DC continuity. I was like, they're married?
Well, I think back then, the idea was you do this wacky cover, and then you have to obviously buy the issue. I know what happens. It's market. But the stories they were creating were inherently, like, idea focused. Like, I have an idea, I'm gonna try out that idea in this issue. And then at some point, and I don't know, maybe it was around the time of 86, or maybe even like...
No, because it's sort of those things started happening with, like, Spider-Man. Because yeah. Spider-Man would have, like, the villain of the week or whatever. They'd introduce, like, whatever.
The Shocker.
Sure, the Shocker. And then meanwhile, Peter's like, Shocker. How can I get a date or whatever? Aunt May's gonna marry Dr. Octopus or whatever. And that's the...
Yeah, and so all of a sudden it went from forward moving into self-reflection.
Yeah.
And then once it turned that corner, then basically they stopped. I don't mean like intentionally. It's not like they said, we're going to stop having ideas. But it's like they started going, let's look at the ideas we've already got and bring out the nostalgia for those older characters.
Do people want, like, does the average buyer want it, though? I mean, look at the pushback against Superman and Wonder Woman going on a date. Like, it should always be Superman and Lois. Why? Like, is that an interesting story? Like, I didn't think it was an interesting story 20 years ago. It wasn't an interesting story 10 years
what
ago.
That's what I think is, like, there's the truth and sort of Moore's thing, and that is, like, just get on with it. Like, who? Because people get so weird about stuff. Like, when I worked at a comic store, that Spider-Man reset, that
Brand new day.
I thought it was wicked.
I really liked it.
Yeah. I thought it was amazing. I thought, I'm like, this is fun. Spider-Man, he's not always complaining.
Right? Yeah.
It was great. It was awesome. Yeah. But people were like, no, I'm invested. They're married and this and this. And that's like those 40, 50-year-old fans that are not necessarily that, even like 20 or 30-year-old fans. It's just that if you get stuck in that, like, I care about the characters so much, and we change the status quo, they react, and sometimes it's good for a sale, sometimes it's bad, but it seems like everyone's trying to find that reaction point instead of just writing a good story. Because it's harder, right? Peter and MJ are married. It's way easier to have that moonlighting kind of thing where they're going on dates, and is she going to find out? You know, like, that's...
I think we should jump, like, springboard into talking about moonlighting.
Well, let's get Chris Peterson here. He had something. Feed us your wisdom, sir.
Fetus?
Okay.
Fetus wisdom.
Now that's the setup.
That's your new book, isn't it?
I gotta live up to that setup. It was. Now I forget what I was gonna read. Classic.
Because he's already writing the pitch for Fetus Wisdom.
I guess it was. It was along the lines of where basically these decisions are always made by higher ups. They're never ever someone goes, oh, I want to do this. And then they're like, no, you got to do a 12 issue crossover. And you got to do something. So you better start selling books.
Uh-oh. Okay, keep going.
But stuff like that all started with, you know, Gwen Stacy dying. like years ago. And then all of a sudden people go, oh, you can do this sort of stuff. And so then that's where I think more and more events went higher and higher and higher and had to always escalate further and further and further. And I think the only books that really survive not going into that are the Daredevils and Hawkeyes, because they're kind of underdog and they're allowed to sort of play in their little area. Whereas Avengers are so big and X-Men are so big that I don't even know what this has to do with the topic at all, but they're more controlled by the higher ups.
I disagree.
All right, Ryland is here.
Arm wrestle.
I think. Perfect. Well, I should say I think because I'm not like an expert or whatever, but it started like with Wayne, right? Is that Stan Lee? As I understand it, I could be wrong, but I think I read somewhere that Stan was like busy or on vacation or something, and Jerry Conway turned in the script. And he was like, yeah. They did the book. The book came out, and Stan was like, get killed. What the fuck? Right?
Yeah.
And it was a big deal, yeah. Right? And it was totally not editorially driven. It somehow, like,
well, yeah, that's
it through,
it
was, right?
I just heard Jerry Andrew Conway tell the story, actually. That's Stan Lee's version of the story.
Uh-huh.
But Stan was already on the West Coast. He wasn't day-to-day in Marvel. Uh-huh. And Jerry has stood by. Jerry says that Stan did know. Stan says he doesn't know. So it's somewhere in the middle. Jerry Conway hated the character. He just didn't like character. And like when he took over the book, he's like, I need to mix it up. And Wayne's born. Maybe he's an interesting character. So
it the writer like did it though.
But it was writer driven, absolutely.
And then I think sort of after that, we started having things like, you know, somebody would come up with a good idea, and like that the first Crisis on Infinite Earth wasn't. That was one person's idea, and then it sort of took hold, and everybody had to go along with it, like editorial latched onto it, something like that.
Yeah, it was high up in the company, mostly Paul Levitz wanted Crisis to happen, and it was a huge infighting over what would be the outcome of Crisis.
But then it kind of like happened, right? That was like a big crossover, and they sort of pushed that through, and editorial started pushing that. And then after that, I think we started having more engineered stuff like Fall of the Mutants, Extinction
that's
Agenda.
That's what I'm saying, yeah. Like it was a kickoff.
And that stuff was just all editorially driven, right?
Right.
But I think since then, like post that, we started having like Marvel roundtables with, what are they called? There's like a team.
The Brain Trust. Whatever
the Architect, yeah. Right? And then you have like Mark Miller is like, we're doing Civil War.
Yeah.
And then editorial is like, what is it? And he's like, well, this. And they kind of like champion it, but it's coming from the creators through editorial, but doesn't mean that it's good, because we got like Matt Fraction did that thing that was a flop.
Fear Itself?
Yeah. And I was the only person who liked it. Like, I thought it was really cool.
I enjoyed it too. I thought it was fun.
So I think it's like one writer's dictating and then editorial pushes it on everyone else. They just be like, okay, all you guys, this is what's happening. But it's like weird, because it's from editorial, but it's from a creator too.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a bit both, because I think they basically say like, okay, we need to do
an event.
I understand someone comes up with the event, but it's still editorial in the sense that they say like, give us an event that we can sell.
And then they push it to everybody else. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
So that's what I meant. Sorry. About
yeah. And what's going on with DC's doing, it's kind of editorial driven. It's kind of pretend you've made your own choice stuff with events, because they've done Night of the Owls and now Zero Year. And what it is that Batman's doing incredibly well, Scott Snyder's Batman, and they're leading up and they're like, okay, so here's the deal. All you guys, you can either tie into the book and the storyline and do an event tie-in, or you can take a pass on it. So Batwoman has sat out every event. They haven't done a single event tie-in. Everyone else is like, well, but I get a bonus based on my sales, and it's gonna up it's gonna like add 10,000 units if I do this event. So I guess I'm doing the event.
But and short term, yeah. They have the short term ramp, and then they're dropping lower. I could be. I think I read that.
Comicosity did a piece that it doesn't end up doing a whole lot for the book. It gives you a one off bump.
Yeah,
it doesn't seem to be a good sampling of that. It's not a good sampling opportunity because it's not really organic to what you were doing. So it's, why would you keep going when it's a self-contained story that's not kind of drawing you to the next?
Do you think we're
going
to cut you off? Brett Monroe wants to feed us his lack of wisdom for a moment?
Thank you.
Well, I was thinking, I mean, based on what you're talking about, I have two things, but is the question of now certainly, like, Mark Miller being more popular and a bigger name draw, like Jeff Johns and stuff like that, if they come to the table with an event, they are certainly more likely to get their event chosen than if, you know, like Joe Bob Comics comes to the table and says, I have an event too.
I'm a fan of Joe Bob Comics' work personally.
And then I also want to do...
Sorry, I'm both sad about it.
Which is completely different than BJ Comics.
Yeah. And I also just wanted to question, because Alan Moore... yes, that's still part of the topic, but I know that in some of his Image work for Rob Liefeld, I mean, he wrote Supreme, which of course was a very superhero comic, and it was completely aping that Superman style of the 50s and stuff like that. And so
totally.
It just seems to me very odd that he can talk this way about comics and then basically propagate it with some of his work that was well after Watchmen.
It was intellectually aware, though, that it was aping as you're reading it.
Sure, but it's still a superhero comic, you know.
Right. So, well, Jason, please, go ahead.
Sorry. Well, and just to jump in on that, I think you made a good point that he is intentionally riffing on an older genre so that there's a metatextual commentary going on there. But I mean, say the flip side is that Alan Moore doing a Supreme that reads like a 50s Superman in that kind of cartoonish silly way is actually probably more fun than the dark and gritty Supreme that came for us, like more compelling to read.
Absolutely.
And I think the other two is that even that Supreme work, that's like 20 years old now. And Alan Moore made this comment like a week ago, 2 weeks ago. So there's kind of a time period needs to be acknowledged.
He still had time to change his opinion, is what you're saying? It's not like he did that last week and then at the moment.
It's not like he was in the middle of like typing like Supreme issue number 17.
And then he's like, fuck, I hate Supreme. Yeah.
Like,
finished it off.
But even in his more recent work, does harken back to superheroes. League of Extraordinary Gentlemen has all the superhero motifs running through it.
But that's like 10 years old.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah,
that's well, no, but we still get new, we're still getting new League stuff.
Yeah, we'll get that 79. They're not written by him, though.
Yeah.
Well, that's Tom Strong I'm thinking.
And even that's an interesting point, though, too, is that like you look at the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, and although it has an adventure fiction quality to it, There's a sense of meta commentary. There's a sense of
it's definitely more literary.
Yeah, yeah. He's actually specifically like he's specifically winking at the audience. Like, did you recognize that reference that I just put in the background of a panel?
And the new stuff that he's doing isn't the same group that he was working with the first time he did the League. So it's at least fresh in that he's using a different time period and a different group of literary characters.
Yeah.
I just keep talking.
Go Riley.
I just keep this all on side motion. Like with Moore, I take Moore sort of issue with him. Okay, sure, superheroes are juvenile and whatever, right? I take Moore issue with him saying, "Well, people are stealing my old ideas," because the best Alan Moore shit is the stuff he's stealing.
Yeah.
Like something.
Yeah.
Not his League. Not his. Like From Hell. It's okay. Not his. Necronomicon? It's something. And that's his, right?
Yeah.
But the stuff that was like huge. Oh, V. V is the only thing that.
V's great.
Yeah.
Even V has those faces on it.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It still has something.
There's a cultural repository that he's kind of drawing.
That's more the weird thing that he's mad about stealing Green Lantern. People stealing. I'm like, dude, like.
Yeah.
Roscoe's?
That's a good point.
So I think at some point these kind of major comic players just become characters of themselves. Characters, like, intentionally so, because they're so tired of dealing with any of this stuff, they just play the part that they've assigned to themselves or been assigned over the years.
Frank Miller as well.
Frank Miller's
a different story. I think he's actually just gone off the deep
end. with his technique and his art, though, his art has become, like, a joke. Like, he's a parody of himself, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's a
it's
self-referencing.
When he started making
stuff.
Movies, it went to the next level. Like, he made The Spirit.
Yeah.
I'm taking my shoes off. My feet are free.
That's a good choice.
I'm just saying.
Whatever makes you want. I wonder how Moffitt is going to keep that kind of persona up.
I feel like Alan Moore's been, he's being asked the same questions for 30 years. And after 30 years of answering the same questions, you're like, fuck it, I'm going to say they're
just
all
say stupid
emotionally
stuff.
Subnormal. Let's see what happens.
It's also worth the noting he was never comfortable with his role as the comic book guy for quotes. He always hated the conventions and people at being interviewed. He's never participated that much in the comic book world.
But he went on The Simpsons.
Moore was part of this movement in the 80s that thought they were going to transform comics into a completely new art form. And in some ways they did, and in some ways they absolutely did not. Because 60% of comics through Diamond are still superhero books from two publishers. And the work that those guys did, and then led into Image, most of the books that the guys around this table have created owe a lot to that era and then to the self-published stuff that came in the 70s prior. But 60% of the comics, at least, are still costume superheroes that Moore thought they would be putting on the shelf for 5 years.
Mm-hmm. I'm actually surprised that the number is as low as 60. So to me, that would actually imply
we made some gains.
There's a positive trend in the sense, like, I don't think superheroes should go away.
No,
but
they just need to be a smaller part of the pie.
Yeah. And I think, like, Riley, you were talking about the sales trend. It's like, you know, that they'll do an event which spikes it, but then when it goes back down lower than it started at the moment before. So there's, like, essentially there's this sort of kind of circling thing where they're going to essentially end up with only the fans who will read that no matter what. Basically.
Well, and there's also, there's like, that's the sales trend, and then the other thing that's sort of contributing to that is that, I don't know if there's any data about this, but like in the 80s, 70s and 80s, those breakout titles like Swamp Thing and like Moon Knight, people talk about like the Moon Knight run with Doug, I don't know how to say his last name, Munch?
We discussed that.
We had a whole episode. And same with Bill Sienkiewicz or Sienkiewicz or whatever.
Yeah.
Like that book doesn't fit in an Avengers universe. Doesn't fit in. So like Marvel has Spider-Man, X-Men, Avengers, right? And everything sort of goes into those. So when you have a Hawkeye or an Iron Fist, they inevitably what's that?
Yeah. Shelby's.
They kind of end up suffering because those big crossover titles suck up all fans' money. So even within the superhero genre, you only get one sort of like product that's Spider-Man, X-Men, Avengers, because you can't afford to buy your Hawkeye. Because you're like, well, he's an Avenger, but it doesn't tie in, so it's not going to be important to that big whatever is going to happen.
The worst line that someone would say when they're asking about a book, it's not, is the book good? Is it going to last long enough for the story to get told? But the line is, does it count?
Yeah.
Does it matter?
What, is it real? Is anything going to change?
Like,
yeah. I hate that.
Yeah. Matt Fraction has actually talked about that somebody asked him about like how hard it is to write superhero books. And I think he was saying that it's a perpetual, you're writing in a perpetual two-act structure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So every time you're about to get to the third act where something would conclude or end or finish for a character, that's where it's a false third act that just actually leads into another first act.
And that's the trick of it, right? That's totally true. But that's why, like, I think Mark Waid, to me, Mark Waid's like the best superhero writer.
Yeah.
He just writes good stories, and that Daredevil run, it's just so good.
That's great.
It just keeps spinning into itself, but you get that resolution. Oh, you don't know, right? Like,
yeah.
It's good.
I thought it was such great news when they announced that Jeff Lemire's Animal Man was ending. Because they're not canceling the book. Jeff Lemire's done telling the story that he wanted to tell. Like it's something that hardly ever happens in Marvel DC now.
No, that needs to happen. Let the creators have a go. Tell their story. Let them end their story. Bring new people. You don't have to end continuity or restart the entire book series, but you know, let people tell individual story completely.
That is the pattern, you know, when a person takes over a book, it seems like they're gonna wipe everything clean that the previous people did so they can start fresh, tell their own story instead of build on it and use it. So
Ben's arguing the universe of fucking ending.
But that's why it's good then to play. So if you're not going to put everybody's toys back, how you find them at the end of it, do the Watchmen. That's what I like about the Watchmen. They're supposed to be the Charlton characters, like you said, and they're like, no, you're going to break these kids. Like, these toys are going to be broken.
Yeah.
When you get them back, no amount of crazy glue is going to fix them, right?
Yeah,
I feel like you could
do
that.
So that's good. Just break them then. Just do it and break them.
Yeah.
I think you can do that, like a story with a Hulk or a Spider-Man or an Avenger. Break the toys and let somebody else just go do a different story and disregard.
I think you should just like finish your story then, yeah. And you're like, later, everything's back. Who cares? It's
just the
like Simpsons, right? Like yeah, Simpsons, exactly. Some stuff counts.
I think that's something we do see is that you do see people come in there and wipe it clean, and because of that, nothing seems important. If nothing seems important, if every event, if every time per character dies, you're just going, well, were they coming back alive? All of a sudden, that doesn't have any impact anymore.
I think that's on the readers, though. You need to shift what you're considering important about reading a comic book. You want continuity.
No,
and
I see.
Enjoy the actual story.
I know what you're saying, Ben, but that would be true if they weren't selling it as event comics. That would be true if they were just telling stories, but they're not. They're selling event comics just like they sell event movies. Nobody, you know, the summer blockbusters aren't movies that are the best told stories. They're the event movies they've designed to get you in there. The comic books have followed the same marketing pattern of event comic books, event crossovers, event whatever, people dying. As long as they're doing that, and that's how they're selling it to you, and eventually you know that that event doesn't actually have any impact. But nowadays, what's the event of Civil War? You know, which had so much put into it. And what is it today, 2013, as we head into 2014?
Yeah.
Well, Captain America's alive.
Yeah. 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 So Tony Stark.
Well, Iron Man's a leading character now.
Yeah. I know what you mean.
Yeah.
I know what you mean. Yes, I enjoy Civil War.
Well, I get where you're coming from as well. Yeah. That you put that investment in and they told you it was going to be worthwhile and pay off and they've sold you that bill. But that's what I'm talking about. Maybe we just ship that and they have to stop selling it that way.
They have to stop selling it that way to begin with.
Yeah. Sort of on the topic of the emotionally subnormal. Dealing with sort of like this, how the story keeps going, but at the same time, the audience shifted because editors decided they shifted. Because they, at one point in the 90s or whatever, they said, look, we used to make comics for kids, but now those kids have grown up, so we gotta keep on catering to them. We don't cater to kids anymore. But they still keep that emotional tie of nostalgia of being a kid, reading a comic. They still want to read about their characters when they were kids. they're still grabbing those pieces along the way to hold on to those kids reading comics.
It's marketing nostalgia.
Yeah.
Basically, like here's something that you remember loving, continue to love it and pay us money, you know.
Yeah, and they don't want to wreck that. But they don't want to grow the audience. They want to keep the audience that still remembers Batman in the 80s and 70s. They still want to remember
that. So is that what Alan Moore is saying within the article? Like, is that what the group kind of, you know, can agree on? Is that Alan Moore is saying, you know, these books are not being made for the audience they should be? Or they're not being made?
I think, I mean, my reading of it is that superheroes as a genre are little kids. They're men in colored in brightly colored costumes, and that tell very simple morality plots. And that's for children. And you know, at other times he's been vague about what he thinks of comics as a medium. But he hasn't written a guy in a brightly colored costume in 15 years. The stuff he's writing is for grown-ups. And I mean, it's interesting that he stretched it into films. That you know, we're now getting like you know R-rated superhero films, you know, R-rated films with guys in bright colored clothes. So does this genre support more complex stories?
Other than Kick-Ass, it's another one.
The Punisher.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a strange criticism because like you know. My love of Batman is mostly a TV show of the 1960s. And, you know, there is that nostalgia of the comic book out now, which I actually don't pick up. I was, but it wasn't the nostalgia that I wanted. My nostalgia ended in, like, 1989 or whatever, of you know, sort of that era of Batman. So is comic books as a medium then... I guess is Alan Moore's criticism of it valid? Like, is the medium still supposed to be for children,
well,
or is
guilty spot for picking up a comic book, picking up a Daredevil, and making it feel me, making me feel like a 12-year-old kid again. I love that about it. And should I feel guilty about that?
I guess what I'm saying is, you know, is the medium of the comic book meant to, is it meant for the medium of the superhero comic book? Is it meant for the 9 to 14-year-old, or is the 9 to 14-year-old's introduction into comic books the film?
I've got a better question.
That's because mine was terrible.
Now, you got a C-minus on there.
I like this. It was a discussion I had with someone yesterday, because they were furious at me for pointing out that Harry Potter written for 12-year-olds. There's a big difference between a book that makes me feel like I was 12 again and a book that is written for 12-year-olds that I can also enjoy.
Yeah.
There's a huge chasm between those two things.
Parallel to, like, superhero comics is she aged her stories with her audience as well, though. So if she was still writing Harry Potter, what would they be like now? Because those got darker and grittier the longer.
Yeah, they did get darker. And Alan Moore would say she shouldn't have.
Yeah.
I know. I disagree. I don't think Alan Moore is saying that she shouldn't have aged her story. I think it's probably not worth analyzing his statement down too specific a line. But I think what Alan Moore is trying to synopsize the man.
Trying to figure out Alan Moore. Good luck.
Yeah, here we go. Yeah.
Get your finger claws out.
You got the best beard to start.
Though. I know it's well. I'm working. I'm a fan, so it's going to get down to here eventually. I think what he's trying to get at is that the stories, like the emotionally, with the word subnormal,
I think what he's
commenting on is that the books and the industry overall are. The problem with that lack of a real ending is that it's also a lack of an emotional closure, and I think that's kind of what he's getting at, is that there's a danger or an inherent problem with the narrative by never letting something end.
That goes into the, I mean, Riley liked it, but. Yeah, that goes into the nullifying of Peter's marriage. Is that because he grew up, got married, and people were like, he's married now, I don't really like that. And so then they're like, okay, fine, he's back to being a bachelor again.
I like that they all talk like that.
And then so then people didn't like that growing up. They didn't like growing up. They wanted to be back to Peter Parker in high school or Peter Parker in college or whatever. So, yeah, they don't emotionally close it off. They keep on catering to that person that wants that Peter Parker of 1963.
Mm-hmm. But what Alan Moore said, what is the outcome? Because like it's clearly a criticism of what superheroes are, you know, have been.
I think more criticism of the audience, Scott. I think it's that Alan Moore seems to me like he has the image of going to the Comic Con and seeing the people that are, you know, fat and unemployed and living at home in their parents' basement. And those are the people that love the comic books that have dressed up. And doing the cosplay. And
I think it. Can I just interrupt and say that's unfair, Ben. Sorry.
I think it's also actually a bit into it. I think he's making a critical statement about the industry, and I think it might. If you personally are enjoying the things that he's criticizing about the industry, then I can see how you might take it a bit personally. But I don't think he's trying to direct that at the.
Well, I do think though that there is
necessarily.
We do see those people at a con. Don't get me wrong. You do. I mean, you always will. And you always have, but I don't think you see them to the same level. I mean, there used to be a time when somebody would be embarrassed to say, I read comic books. I just go in a restaurant, open it up, and start reading them. And I think there's less of that today than there once was. And because of that, the image is changing. I don't know that the audience is actually different than it ever has been, but I think the image that these people are somehow emotionally stunted and socially stunted or that one existed is still out there.
It sort of comes down to that. Like, some of it is that period of time that you grew up with something. Like, with the Spider-Man thing, I just happy, like, to have fresh Spider-Man stories, right? And that's the Spider-Man that I think is funner is when he's just figuring his shit out, right? Yeah. But it works either way. If you grew up in the 60s, you like Bachelor Peter, right? Mm-hmm. And if you grew up in the 80s, usually you're more like Peter and Mary Jane together.
Like your favorite James Bond matter. Is whoever was your first James Bond.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, yeah. And same with, like, Star Wars, right?
Yeah.
Like, my brother is 13 years younger than me. he thinks Darth Maul is awesome.
Yeah,
and he still does. He still thinks it's cool. He's like, yeah. I've seen the first ones. They're better films. But I think Darth Maul is awesome. So
whatever.
So that's like, it's just that adherence to whatever you sort of grew up with. So there, I think there is some of that. Like, because you're visiting childhood. You're returning to that. So maybe you are emotionally. Maybe I'm emotionally stunted that I like it so much.
Star Wars is an interesting example of it because so much of the anger about the Star Wars prequels is that they didn't grow up with us. Like, we went to them like, frick, this is for 8-year-olds.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You know, like Star Wars was when I was eight inside. Why did I want, like, why did people turn up looking for something for 40-year-olds?
Yeah. Like, I'm okay with Ewoks, right? But if you saw
I love
A
that
New
cartoon.
Hope, or if A New Hope was your first one you saw, you're like, Ewoks are stupid. And my little brother's kind of like, that Gungans are kind of stupid. But,
They're from my era of Star Wars. Yeah, there's an ownership.
They're my stupid thing.
Exactly.
But my kid loves Gungans.
Well, there you go.
So, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, that's a win.
Yeah, kids love Jar Jar, too. Like.
Yeah, and yeah. Why not?
They should. Like, it's kids fun. That's why I always get like really.
I'll tell you why not.
I'll tell you. We need an extra comic.
Yeah, that's why it's always funny to see, like, especially now, like year-end movie reviews and best and worst of lists, and all the worst of lists are all comprised of, like, you know, PG movies that some 40-year-old film blotter is like,
enjoy.
This is a terrible movie. But it's like, well, it's all relative, you know.
Yeah, it wasn't made for them.
Yeah,
I remember reading a review by Roger. Like Siskel and Ebert about Pokemon movie, and they're like, two thumbs down. I'm like, why the hell are you watching it anyway? Yeah.
I don't know any of these characters are.
Don't you have like a granddaughter that you could take to the movie and just have her review it?
Exactly.
I don't care. Flubber was great.
It's too sad. Too sad.
Flubber was great.
It's like it happened all across like sort of geek culture. Like I just found out recently. Like I'm really bad at the Facebooking. And there was this thread about Zack Snyder. And these people were just saying how he's the worst. And I was like, oh, Zack Snyder's okay.
you are bad at me.
300 has muscly guys throwing spears and crazy violence. And there's lots of boobs. And it's fine.
Yeah.
Apparently it's not. Apparently it's not. Yeah. It's all because people are like worried. I don't know. The Superman, Batman, that's where this came from, and I was just...
Well, why don't we just say, if this is the end of the day, a good story is a good story, and a kid should be able to read and enjoy a good story, and why can't an adult too? If it's well told, well written, you know, dialogue is good, it's well paced, everything, the art's good, then what's the problem? Why can't everybody enjoy it?
I agree, I think the problem right now is that kids, it's harder for them to enjoy comics.
Absolutely.
Comics, yeah. Whereas I can go back and read comics that I read when I was a kid, when I fell in love with comics, and they're still good there.
And then, but the movies will, you know, I mean, if you look at, you know, the Batman movies, you know, Christopher Nolan's movies, I mean, how comfortable are you showing those to a 6-year-old, 5-year-old if you have one?
I'm about as comfortable as showing them the comic books.
Exactly. Yeah. And the kind of everything kind of.
It was a question about Batkid, which was, you know, such a great story this year. The little kid that all of the volunteers got together and gave him a Batman day.
Yeah.
But the kid's like 4 years old, and I couldn't help thinking during the whole thing, what is his exposure to Batman? Where does he know this character from?
You never read Batman.
He's a fake geek. He's like the store-bought costume, for God's sake.
He made it himself.
Probably the late cartoon.
Brave and the Bold. Yeah. I love that.
Yeah, it's great.
Oh, yeah. A lot of kids get into Spider-Man through the Spider-Man show.
How about that? The DC Universe, I mean, they gave us these great cartoons here in the last 15 years or whatever. You know, Batman.
Teen Titans Go.
Stuff like that. That it can be enjoyed by adult and children.
Yeah. I think the draw for kids now is more just iconography. Like, I have a niece who's 4, and she loves Spider-Man and some of the Spider-Man Marvel characters and stuff like that. She's never read it.
She
doesn't even, I don't think she watches a lot of the shows, and if she does, she doesn't quite, you know, she's 4, she's not soaking it in, but she saw a Spider-Man plush doll, and she was like, oh, I like that, that looks really cool, and this is my thing.
I have nieces and nephews who are 4 and 5, and there were some leftover action figures from my brother-in-law at my parents-in-law's house, and the kids are playing with them, and so I started asking them questions about the superheroes. Because one of the kids loves Spider-Man. So what do you know about Spider-Man? He's seen one or two of the cartoons, maybe a little bit. One of the girls said she loves Wonder Woman. I said, "What do you know about Wonder Woman?" And she gave me this look that could that I realized I might have asked her, "What do you know about Barbie's backstory?" Because she knows what Wonder Woman looks like. What else is there to know?
Yeah, and she knows. This is kind of an interesting thing to kind of try to tie it back to the his original statement about emotionally subnormal.
Why would we do that?
I want to know Barbie's backstory.
Wrap up the topic and move on to the next one. So,
please, continuity heavy. Ryan really continuity heavy.
Barbie 0 year. But it's in a way, I think there's actually kind of an interesting thought about that. Like, what else do I need to know? I think, like, maybe the beauty of superheroes, maybe when they're at their best, is when they're almost free of continuity, when they're simply Superman being Superman, Spider-Man being Spider-Man, and that there's kind of like that the continuity is maybe the problem? Question mark? I think Dark Knight Returns, the whole idea on that was like, what if Batman actually got old and didn't stay 30 for 70 years?
Sure. Or Franklin Richards is like 10 his whole life.
Yeah. So like, it's, and anyway, that I think to me, there's actually something almost poetic or beautiful about the idea of Wonder Woman being that, like, you don't need to know Themyscira and whatever her mom's name is, Hippolyta.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You don't need to know that because she's Wonder Woman. She's saving somebody, you know? She is who she is. It's kind of, there's something actually, I think poetic about that. I'm enjoying it.
I do like the notion of creating a superhero with no backstory and just being like, this is the guy. He looks awesome. He
punches the bad guys. And
tells good
today.
Stories. Yeah. And then that's it. And everybody's like, what's his origin? What's his origin? It's like, he doesn't have one. You will never know.
Yeah.
And never cave under pressure.
And there are always two issue arcs.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the problem. Maybe because you go back to like the early 90s stuff, it was always like Spider-Man was like a two issue, part one of two. And it was like, he would fight Electro and Punisher would show up. And it was really cool. Like,
what Mo was gonna, I'm gonna speak for Mo here. Yeah. There was a whole group of people that got sold on comics as continuity, though, that liked that part of it.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's a whole bunch of different varied audiences.
No, that's true.
I think it's very interesting, actually, that we talked about the event and all this in the event. The event movie. Meanwhile, television, the shows like Walking Dead are so continuity heavy, they're not necessarily event driven anymore. They're character driven, and it's actually the difference has actually occurred, I think, in television. You know, shows like Game of Thrones and whatever, they're, you know, it's more continuity heavy and more driven than overall story arc. So, I don't know what that means.
Yeah, well, like, that's Breaking Bad is all continuity.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, I think that we're going to wrap this one up, but if the next book, To Come Out of Monkey Brain, from Ryan, is about a superhero without a backstory that comes out of this whole thing, I'll be proud as hell.
Start it here first.
I'm telling you.
I'm going to do a superhero without a back. No back.
Front man.
Front shoulder man.
Shoulder man. He never walks backwards and just going forward.
He's got the weight of the world.
Front shoulders.
Spineless.
Wonderful. All right, let's
272 break.
Man.
Take a little break. You guys can use the washroom, get some drinks, and we'll come back to talk to the next subject. So, you guys are awesome. That was incredible stuff.
Fuck you, Mo. Don't tell him what to do.
Moving on to our second topic today, which is getting noticed, breaking into the industry, Web 3.0, Comixology Submit. How do you get into the industry in 2013, 2014? How did you? Ben wants to say it, but what we're going to do here is actually, we're going to go around.
Nepotism.
And
Ben,
we're gonna go around, starting with Ben, and he can make the comment on this. But I actually want to, based on that last conversation, I just want to know, go around the room here from everybody and find out what is the first book that they recall reading that was not a superhero book, or say an Archie book, or something like that that was more mature reader's book or adult-oriented, they can recall. What kind of broke them into that genre? So, Brett?
Well, the first book that I remember reading that was called Icon Devil. And it had a lesbian scene, so I was a huge fan.
Yeah, you gave me that book.
5 out of 5. I read it too.
A plus, what did we get? Bones.
It managed, it managed 2 issues twice. That was it. Like, it released the first 2 issues and then stopped dead, and then it came back like 10 years later and managed the first 2 issues again. Wow. And then stopped. So.
Well, that was awesome. Chris, a co-host here. I think I remember one particular trip to the comic store, and I remember I picked up an issue of Sandman number 7 and the first issue of Peter Bags 8. That was an awesome cool. trip.
Mm. That's awesome.
I think because, like, right when Brian Michael Bendis was starting to make waves in Marvel, I started to, like, backtrack and see what he did prior. So I'm thinking it was Torso, and it scared the shit out of me. Like, it was pretty messed up at the time. But yeah, I think that was it.
Good luck, though.
It was good.
I remember before I even read superhero comics, I read British comics, like, you know, and stuff like that. But those were for kids. So the first, like, not-for-kids, not-superhero book I read was, I think, Ralph Snart. If you guys remember that?
I do.
Which is like,
who is that comics. For, though? Yeah. Who is Ralph Snart?
I don't think it's for, it wasn't for me.
I don't know.
I think I was so young that I didn't see for what it was. I was just like, oh, that guy has a big nose and a flat top hair, he looks cool. But then, like, I read them when I was older, like 16, and I was like, whoa.
Check him out on Twitter. He tweets all the time.
Does he?
He's hilarious.
He's not real.
I don't care. He's funny.
Are you emotionalism?
Yeah, I think that was my first. Yeah.
I was gonna buy it at the store, and they were like, "Put that back. That's not for you." But I was young at the time.
Yeah.
It wasn't yesterday.
No.
Okay. And then I took a huge break, and then I think after that it was like Jason, his books from like Fantagraphics.
Oh.
But that's much later. That's post Snart. That's my post Snart. P.S. decade.
Chris.
Now that I think about it, it was heavy metal.
Yeah.
And that was, I think even prior to, almost prior to, I think even actually reading superhero comics. Because the only way I could get heavy metal comics was when I took trips, on the Greyhound, visiting between my parents. Between sometimes Calgary and Medicine Hat. And in the bus stations, they had the heavy metal. And no one questioned me when I was 13.
Did you wear like 12? A fake trench coat?
No. Oh, that's a rough trip all the way from Vancouver.
Yeah. With another kid on his shoulders.
No, but it was they no one, because it was someone who behind the counter didn't even care. And this is at the time when they were still smoking in Greyhounds and stuff like that. So they didn't care about kids. In general, so I would buy heavy metal magazines, and then I had seen a Spider-Man comic later, but it was heavy metal first, I guess.
You were disappointed, right? No boobs in this.
Well, actually, it was McFarlane, so it had a little.
Oh, had some action.
No, but yeah, that would be it.
Cracked. No, I actually, that would probably be it. Was Cracked Magazine.
Right
up. Was the, because that's not big too, is it?
No, I don't know who was that.
No, it wasn't. Matt is owned by Warner. Cracked.
What was it that
I loved
Marvel
Cracked
did attempt to do one? Cracked style, the Mad style magazine. Was it Boom or was it not Brandeck?
No.
No, that's not the one I'm thinking of.
No, it wasn't.
It ran for 3 issues, or 2 issues. 2 or 3 issues.
Yeah.
I can't remember what it was.
They did try a new one, it didn't last long.
My first comic was Tales of G.I. Joe number 2, I think. And then the first comic that had boobs in it was Savage Sword. Savage Sword, there's your worst Leo cover in Jumbie Sema, Ernie Chan inside. Yeah. And there's this little
black nipple. We're going by boobs now. It's the first book that you got with boobs.
Okay. What was your first dick mag? Jason.
Only Jason gets to answer that one.
No, that was to
everyone. Let's be more inclusive, guys.
You were winking at me when you said it.
Yeah.
Old black kisses.
Watchmen.
Go with your first dick.
Yeah. First dick in a comic.
Watchmen. Stepping back from the question of the Dickman. No, I Conan is actually, I think I was gonna say Frank Miller's Ronin, but I think that was the first one I bought. But the first one I encountered was actually a Conan with Barry Windsor Smith.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Nice. Does that have nipples in him?
No, actually. It was always like strategically placed like ferns. You know, they were kind of getting in the way of Red Sonja there. But yeah. And then Ronin.
Well, you mentioned G.I. Joe, and G.I. Joe would be the first like non-superhero thing I read.
Oh, come on, that's still superhero.
The first mature readers book that I got was The Unknown Soldier by Christopher Priest, called Jim Owsley at the time. And I had to get my older brother to buy it for me because I was only 14 or 15 when it came out. And it was the first comic that I bought that had Suggested for Mature Readers stamped on the cover.
And somebody actually followed that at the
comic
shop.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow.
Yeah.
Can I interject really fast?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, speaking of selling stuff to people who you shouldn't, when I worked at the comic store, there's this kid that came in that said he really wanted Punisher stuff. And I was like, how old are you? He's like 17. I'm like, okay. Well, there's this Marvel Knights Punisher. I think it's okay. He's like, yeah, I read it. It's not a thing. I'm like, how old are you? He's like 17. I'm like, show me your ID. He shows me his ID. I'm like, okay. Well, there's Punisher Max. Can you handle it? Is your mom going to spaz out? He's like, no. So he buys three trades of it. Comes back 4 hours later. Gives me those back. He's like, I couldn't handle it. I was just like, I'm really sorry. Don't tell your mom. Maybe tell your mom.
He couldn't handle it?
No refunds.
I read the first trade and I gave it away. This was too much for me.
Like, here's some Chris Claremont X-Men. He's like, thanks.
Here's the boys, volume one.
Chris Claremont is a palate cleanser.
Did you wrap him in a blanket as he walked?
Brown bagging.
Ben, and then you can comment on breaking into industry.
Comes perfectly all around.
I mean, I didn't get superhero. Well, I got superhero comics pretty early, but my first comic book was an illustrated Bible, of course. It was like Action Comics Bible.
Jesus is a superhero.
It was a pretty, I love the art. It was in that kind of old, like, serious style that they had in the 60s. I can't remember. I was trying to find the guy's name, but I can't remember it. And then there was the superhero Archie stuff for a while. And then when I was 9, my mom bought me this grab bag of comics in the store, and tucked into the middle between a couple Spider-Man issues, and I think like it was a Black Panther issue, was this comic. I can't remember the name of it, but it was just this heinous indie comic about this world where religion had become like this big overall ruling fascist state, and they'd outlawed all forms of music, and it was the most violent, sexually aggressive book I've ever seen. I was like 9.
Whoa.
And I kept that book hidden in my room and reread it so often. I was just like, this is radical. I have no idea that there was a world outside of like this kind of religious world that I was raised in where stuff like this could happen.
If I just want to check before we get into the getting noticed thing, is I think one thing I think interesting that I've noticed as we kind of go along is that not only are our non-superhero, because the question was just non-superhero books, yet almost all of our choices were in some way generally transgressive, you know, mm-hmm. which I think is interesting. I think, I don't know if that's, I'm not trying to make a comment or imply a comment, but I think there is a kind of an interesting correlation there that, like, it's not like, there were no just, like, nobody just said a Western, you know,
nope.
Or like...
Actually, here's something, man.
I have a better question, Jason.
But I do actually.
What does transgressive mean?
So, if you're going to give something to somebody that's going to be transgressive, that's produced today, that you wanted to introduce somebody who's only reading comic books to, what would it be?
It depends on the person.
Yeah?
And what would be transgressive to sort of their beliefs or their system of beliefs.
All right, let's move in. Ben. Breaking into comics, 2013. What was the best way?
2014 should be the proper.
The best
way.
You
should cut me off.
I'm gonna be taking notes.
No. Well, you're. It's brand. It's wide open.
It depends on who you talk to, but I mean, comics have continued to be largely about who you know and know people, and it's not always a conscious sort of clicky thing that happens, but generally meet people from other people that you know, and that seems to be a pretty effective way of being able to find people that will publish your work. Working on something for next year because I met a guy at a thing and we became friends.
Chris Peterson.
Twitter. well, actually, I did start a lot of stuff on Twitter. But to build off of Ben's, as much as we want to say that it's pure hard work and pure talent and pure this, a lot of the extra crank to push it forward is knowing someone. And then it's up to you to keep that crank going. Like, I mean, you get that sort of like that one sort of shot sometimes to get the crank. I mean, and there are people who don't. Like, and there's obviously good. Obviously, someone gets there purely on their own. Purely like, I'm a spectacle and I'm awesome, and you just get purely going on your own. But the generalness of it is you're building off of usually someone else knows someone. Someone recommends someone, and it always builds off of like, hey, who do you know that can do this, or who's your best friend, or
who's
like my best
work with.
Yeah, like it's
a
lot of
prank.
Yeah, a lot of it is like everyone thinks that they can just like submit, and get work going, and that's one in a thousand or one in a million type of thing. Half the time, one person gets in the front door, all the 50 people get in the back door. Like, you know what I'm saying?
It's coattails, man. Just hold on tight.
and I see a lot of it. Like, I see a lot more of it, even, like, you know, in the past 2 years, I've seen way more than I had before. Before, I just thought it was, yeah, just like, keep on submitting stuff and, you know, it'll go good. And yes, it'll happen, but at the same time, a lot more times you get your chances
Well, the flip side of that, though, would be that despite the issue of nepotism, is that to be asked by your friend, you already have to have shown the skill somehow.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, It's not like a publisher is going to just say to their best friend who can't draw this book. Like,
no. You know what I mean? You obviously have to be in the industry. Like, I mean, you obviously have to be doing something.
You have to be able to do the thing that you're trying to do, at least in some capacity, or else.
Yeah.
But achieving that is what.
Yeah, it doesn't necessarily mean that you are the top of the pile if you end up being the person that gets the book to do. It just means that you happen to. In a lot of cases, like, obviously, we have to put all those caveats in, or else people like to interject with, oh, but I had a different situation. The point being is that, yeah, we're not necessarily the best of the best in order to be working on things. There are probably different people that could have done the thing that you end up working on a lot better than you could have done it, or a lot differently, or a lot more interesting, or something like that. But it's just that you had a connection or that interaction with somebody at some point that's kind of opened a particular door for you.
I hate to put a stereotype on it. It's sort of the rap star thing, where one guy gets the break, and then he brings his friends with him, and they all have albums. So, I mean, that's usually where I see it most, is in the rap world, where, you know, whether it's Eminem, you know, gets his break, and then he brings 50 Cent, and, you know, this guy, and this guy, and this guy, and this guy. Right. Like, exactly.
What nobody saw was Stone Cold on his face. Mace.
Mo money, mo problem.
And I just watched the Image documentary where Liefeld just brought in his friends who were just like, you want to draw cool comics? Come draw cool comics with me, or, you know, like, and these guys started making like millions of dollars, and they were just inkers and stuff like that, right? Like, they were like, you want to ink my comic?
just fucking inkers.
Yeah. what I'm saying is, like, usually the superstars were the artists, but even, you know, the inkers, letterists, colors were all like superstars
there's the danger in Image, because there was no one in editorial going, okay, so you got this friend, he's an inker, that's great,
can he do the job? Because you got those Image days, they were hiring everyone they knew that could had the good ink, but they couldn't make a deadline to save their lives. So,
you know, well, I had other problems. But yeah, but given, you know, the only reason why, let's say, for example, I've gotten my give has been because between having the ability to do something, being able to draw a comic, and someone giving you a chance. Actually, mine was more like a little bit of blind faith because I was just given the chance, which was a little bit of an amazing thing. But it was because I knew Jeremy Holt, right? He then retweeted something, and then I replied to that tweet. And then, you know, but without me being on Twitter and not knowing Jeremy, not knowing Ryan, or not knowing anyone, I would have never, you know, I would have been still sitting there trying to submit stuff.
You would have met that other person then, or had your patients presented to that other person at some point.
And then that person recommends someone else, or, you know, recommends me or someone else, and then it snowballs.
So we're not saying you don't get to just walk in because you know so-and-so. You still have to be able to actually do the thing that you're supposed to be. You just may not be the best at doing that thing.
Well, now if I can, this is something like talking about being the best. I think it's
a Pokemon thing.
It's a Pokemon.
You better not understand.
So to sum up, it's which Pokemon you know. That's how you
guys. I'll catch all those motherfuckers.
There's like 750 now, dude.
Yeah.
He does well anyway. Does
so serious.
If he has to catch 750 of them all, that's what he will get.
I'll do it on a lunch break.
I'm not quite sure if I get to Pokemon that fast, but anyway.
You gotta catch them all.
Anyway, I think when we talk about, like, maybe you're not the best inker, but, you know, you happen to know somebody, is that I think that implies that somehow that art should be, or that the creation of art should be democratic. Like, it should have
meritocracy.
Yeah, well, or that even that it should be a meritocracy. And I think there's maybe an interesting, like, what is that narrative that makes us think that we should be plucked out for success based on marital, you know?
It's the old myth that you work hard, you be the best, and then you get everything they want in life. That's a magical little story we've all been told as we.
Well, yeah. and I think that's exactly it.
It doesn't necessarily work that way.
No, I think there's nothing inherently. How do I put this? I think having something handed to you because you have a connection with somebody, like as a friend, you know, like or as a colleague or what have you, doesn't mean that if that work wasn't handed to you, that someone better would have gotten the work.
No, I know. I probably chose the wrong sorts of words. But
no.
The point being, you still, maybe if you get the opportunity, you still have to, you know, show up and do it, or else you're not going to get another chance at some point. It's just the way that I, from my experience being around the industry, not really in it, but just watching sort of how the wheels work, is just that people end up meeting people. It's networking. I guess that happens in every industry, so it's not really a particularly unique thing, but you get that promotion at work because you know, had a good chat with the boss at the bar the other night or whatever.
My other career is in theater, and I mean, like, I produce and direct, and I mean, I see a lot of actors and I see them audition, and it's not a meritocracy, if only because there's times where I need a specific character, and so I'm going to need an actor who can do that, like who can fill very specific criteria for me. So I'll see 50 great actors. They're all equally great. I can only choose one, and I'm going to choose them for reasons that actually have nothing to do with how innately good they are.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, there's always caveats and addendums to generalizations.
Yeah.
I just assume you're all smart enough to fill those in for yourself.
You move on.
Please explain all of the following caveats.
Next writing down caveat. That's look up on Google.
The words of Ben, that's what makes it fucking generalization. If it was specific, it would no longer be one.
Not doing it. Jason.
Well, I kind of agree with you about the making stuff thing, that if you put in the hard work, that's not
necessarily.
That's not necessarily.
You still need to do
and
that.
Who you know is huge, huge, who you know. That's probably like the best way is just network. I mean, you still have to put in those hours to be able to do something.
Yeah.
And sometimes I'm dazzled by how bad some stuff is. I'm like, how do you have a job? But I think that's, like, breaking into comics now is kind of more possible and beautiful than it ever has been before. And it's like, because it's, you can make stuff, you can publish online, you can build a body of work, and the chance of showing somebody that, tweeting it, Facebooking it, is so much higher than going to San Diego or showing a portfolio.
There's right? a million different ways to circumvent that kind of system now that didn't exist before.
Huge, right? So if you just do the work, I think the most important thing now is just doing the work.
Yeah.
Like everybody, they ask, people ask you if you have any published work, well, how did you get in? Like, well, I did like 80 pages of a graphic novel that the publisher was like, maybe we'll publish it. Let's see when you're done.
Yeah.
After 80 pages, he's like, yeah, I guess. It wasn't like, yeah, we're excited, right?
Yeah.
But you do the work. If you don't do the work, if you do like 6 pages, people just like,
yeah.
And what? You did 6 pages. Who cares? That's not a thing, right? Then after that, I think once you get that step in, people see your stuff, and then that's where you get rewarded for how good your work is, right? Like, I didn't know anybody at DC. Nobody. And I just got a call. Hey, do you want to draw Superman? Well, yeah. Well, sure. Is this a joke of some kind? Have you seen myself? Exactly. I thought it was at least the same guy as the Batman digital first two, and I was like, it's a Batman book, sweetheart. I think that, like, end of it. But at the beginning, it was just luck. It was just doing the work and showing up. But yeah. Doing the work is huge.
Yeah, you're not going to maintain after you get your butt if you weren't doing the actual
effort. Like, if you trace those 6 pages, you trace them from Adam Hughes or something, and then hide it real good, right? when you have to do page 7,
someone's going to know. Yeah.
There's trouble, right?
I was at the New York Comic Con back in October, and that was actually, like, pretty much every panel that I was in which somebody asked how do you break into comics, was like, they were saying, like, make something first. Go draw a book. Like, finish a story, do something completely, and then come back. Like, so I think, like, that notion of do the work, like, that it's not a matter of just, as you say, like, practicing those six pages again and again and again, and then finally somehow getting in.
Yeah.
I think some people are still on that mentality that that's how it was done, because that's, in a sense, how you did it at one time, was that you just submit your pages to Marvel, mm-hmm. and then Marvel goes, you know, stamp yes or stamp no type of thing and send it back. And people are still on that mentality. That's how it happens.
Well, you're probably, like, at the end of that, right?
Yeah,
I was for sure.
I was doing exactly that. Like, it was like, oh, I got to draw these 3 Cyberforce pages. And so I'm drawing, and you know, it was like, what are you doing?
I kept thinking, if I can just draw Spider-Man good enough, and the editor would write back, and maybe it was 4 letters. But then I graduated past the 4 letters.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, oh, make some progress. And then they change editors.
Yeah.
Like, submissions editors, and you're like, back down the aisle,
right? You don't know who you are. Like, yeah.
I'd be like, but it'd be like a 4-page Spider-Man story. What do you do with that after? You can't do anything with that. It's not, like, at least if it's your own, like, webcomic or something.
Yeah, you put it up and you can be proud of that.
Yeah.
And continue it.
And the next thing is page 5.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. That's the thing. Like,
yeah. But yeah, that was the, I mean, I was at the store where they still had, you know, submit, where they actually gave you a book.
Cool.
The Marvel Trial book, yes.
Whoa.
And you know, it had like a little script by Labdell or whoever it was, and then you had to draw the 4 pages that they gave you in that book, and then you send the book.
Mark Bagley won that.
Really?
That's how Mark Bagley got
it. Didn't J. Scott Campbell get, like, he won some sort of tryout too?
Wasn't it just recently that DC had like a tryout thing on their website?
Harley Quinn.
Where, like, it was just Harley Quinn in 4 different
sexy poses.
The thing is that person was already
pre-chose or something, right?
He's already a pro.
Yeah.
So that was just like a nice little shiny thing to do so that people would think they had a chance.
So they could get word out about the book. Right?
Shiny baubles.
Look at all the Harley Quinns, and you're going to buy the first issue when it comes out.
And you know what else was weird about that? They didn't even ask for that submission for anybody to do any sequential work.
Probably because
it wasn't a serious thing. They just wanted, like, pinups.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's the number one way to find somebody who doesn't know how to do a story. Like.
And then they got I'm not saying anything bad about the person, but it was very atypical DC art.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't something, ooh, this is neat and interesting.
It's very, like, fine. Like, it was just very there.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. It is, there it is. There's the page. I didn't even notice it until I was like, I had to like specifically go, oh, I guess that's the page. Okay. Moving on.
I'd pay money for that first.
I'd buy that for a dollar.
No more.
So, is networking easier then in this day and age than it would have been 10 years ago? Like, obviously there's Twitter and stuff like that, but I mean, you know, is there, I think there's more conventions now.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
is it conventions? The Twitter thing is huge.
Is it easier to talk to people at a convention and network through that way?
I circumvented conventions because I don't go to a lot of them.
It's your homebody. Yeah.
I'm a homebody. This is my first time out this week. true. I've been using LinkedIn. I literally have an editor at every publisher now. And it was just like an afternoon of going, okay, who can I get in contact through LinkedIn?
Do you feel, Scott, now that you say, unfortunately, Mysterious Strangers is going to go away?
And maybe.
Maybe.
It's gone.
And you've already picked up.
I paid my part in that
it's canceled. Yeah, I bought him, Scott, but I haven't read him yet, but I bought him.
It's cool.
But, reading it's not important to the sales members.
You're actually having to read stuff.
Do you guys retain ownership to it? Or?
Oh, yeah. No.
Okay, so you could chop it around if you guys want to.
No, it's with Oni for a period. I don't remember the contract.
So you've got the right to like pick it up and republish it.
Yeah.
But Scott Malley, Intrepids, and Ready, Set, Fight?
Down, Set, Fight.
Down, Set, Fight. I always get that one.
That's okay.
I'll never get that one. Yeah, Down, Set, Fight.
Mysterious.
Of course, Mysterious Strangers. So how confident are you? You're still a young artist. You're still...
I'm really young.
Yeah, you're still...
You're like 21-year-old Scott Kowalczyk. Wonderkind.
Well, when we first met you 2 years ago, you described yourself as green. You said, I'm pretty green, I'm getting better.
I was sick that day, though, too, so yeah. The green.
Well, it's not you are.
Well, most people are when they talk to me, but...
Yeah, it was gamma radiation.
How confident are you, Scott, now at this stage in your career, that if you lose a job, if you lose that you'll be able to replace it?
You see, that's the thing, right? Because the book went on hiatus, was how it was described, and that's cool. 3 months ago... And my editor had me lined up with a couple other writers a couple days later. So that who you know is actually really important once you're in as well, because as soon as we were told, okay, you know, book's going on hiatus, I was kind of like, okay, well, you know, I didn't have anything else lined up because I thought it to be an ongoing series.
This was your first work for hire, wasn't it?
I guess so. It's kind of work for hire because we still own the IP. But anyway, so that's when I started to get, you know, pick up all my contacts at the other publishers. But my editor just had me lined up 2 days later with another writer, and contracts are in the mail. So once you're actually within the industry, you know, you do have those people, at least in my experience, who are invested in you enough to then kind of take care of you. And I'm not saying that's across the board. I luckily have one editor who likes me. None of the others.
But you have.
And
that
the others, because
you're
the
awesome.
Others you've met.
Chris, thank you. He took care of me. And I'm not saying that everybody would have that. But, you know, that's probably where the networking side of it comes into, where you actually develop relationships. And, yeah.
I have two questions here, kind of based on that. Number one. How about the difference of breaking in as something other than an artist? How about breaking in as a writer, or even a colorist, letterer?
Don't forget letterers. They're important.
They're important. Yeah. How about breaking in into the industry in a different area? You know, we have a couple writers here. And the difference for you guys than necessarily an artist like Scott and Riley and Chris.
I don't think I haven't broken in, so I don't know.
Monkey brain, you're in. What are you talking about?
You're there. You did it.
No,
I saw your gold letter.
No, Scott Snyder tweeted about your book. That's a pretty big deal.
Your book is sitting there as an editor's pick on Comixology all the time.
Yeah,
you gave that in the front page.
It's a process, though.
made a pentagram out of blood.
I did some sigil magic in a jerkball.
Did you jerk it?
So for aspiring writers out there, start jerking it.
Yeah.
Don't forget to jerk off to the sigil after you make it, or nothing will. You will not break it. But I don't know. You know, it's. I think. I guess I can only. I see already there. I see a lot of writers that try.
He's getting excited into that.
He leaned forward in it.
I ruined it. No, I see a lot of writers that are kind of stuck in that, and we all do it. We're just stuck in that, like, hey, I'm going to be a comic writer, and I'm going to work on my pitch for my ongoing or my 12-issue thing, and it's like you just focus your first 2-3 years on just like, I'm going to do this pitch that's huge. And so you know, after a year or 2 years of doing that, you have nothing to show. And no one's going to do anything with it. So I think the best thing to do is to take a year off or however long you need and just do your own stuff. Do short stuff. Write as much as you can. Produce as much.
Breaking in. So go back to the work that Riley's talking about. Yeah. You're still doing the work.
Is it harder to... I think it's harder to get in as a writer because... I don't know why.
Well, less than needed because you can write 4 or 5 books a month.
Well,
But it's harder to, it's a visual medium still, so it's harder to be like, look at my work.
Yeah, like there's,
it's also more saturated for writers. I've had this conversation with some people a number of times about how like, there's a bajillion people out there that read comics as a kid that are like, I'm going to be a comic writer. That's what I'm going to do. I haven't, you know, there's not a lot of practical skill behind me wanting to write a comic, but that's what I'm going to do. Yeah. And some of them get really good.
Yeah.
Some of them don't.
I think what you
and
have
it's just this flood of people though. You can tell with an artist if they can handle it.
If they can tell a story or not. I guess you can't tell a story.
Yeah.
I think the other thing is I think partially it's that it's harder to tell how good a writer is at a moment's notice. We've already said. I think it's also that within the industry, within the jobs that are available, one writer can be doing multiple books.
That too.
So there's like literally less, like if there's like 15 books out, like just say like the whole industry is 15 books, you don't need, like you might need 15 artists, but you don't need 15 writers.
It could be 3 writers.
Yeah.
Sure.
And they do 5 books. So you've got like less jobs and way more people who think they can do it. Because they're like, hey, I can spell mostly.
And isn't it true that every artist wants to be a writer?
Every artist is sort of a writer. We're storytellers. That's what we do. We've already got that in us. Every panel, every comic, we're telling a story visually. It's a different language.
Even Ditko and Kirby were doing stories.
Oh yeah.
So it's not like it's not like a new thing. It's always been.
Happen. Yeah, I mean, we want to tell stories as much as writers want to tell stories. It's not like we're like, I just want to sit down and draw some really pretty panels today.
Yeah. Every artist out of curiosity, what is your I accept what you're saying there. Every artist is a writer.
Well, he's a storyteller.
But why in industry are there not that many writer artists?
It's a lot of work.
It's harder to do. One job is super hard, right?
Yeah.
One job's hard. And then, like, let alone inking, coloring, but just storytelling with, like, visually is hard. Writing is, like, a whole other skill set. So that's why it's so rare to have somebody that can do 2 things. That's, like, 20,000 hours, right? To be good at both.
Yeah.
That's why, like, we got, like, Mignola,
Darwin Cook,
Lemire, Matt Wagner, Eisner.
Please don't say Todd McFarlane.
Brandon Graham.
Graham and Lemire are writing at some unique styles, which is.
I think like there's a big leap between like writing, which is to say like getting the story out, like, you know, this person went here and did this thing, and writing in a way that that can have the same effect on somebody through words that a panel can have. So, like, or to find the great juxtaposition between them. So I think like that's the, what you're saying, it's a hard job, and the amount of work that it takes to figure out that, not just putting words out there, but the exact right words.
Yeah, that's,
can be,
like, that's the hard part.
Yeah, like the dialogue. Like,
yeah, like I read tons of stuff. I have all kinds of ideas. I'm like, here's a scene. I don't know what happens in these 12 pages.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I know.
And even if I do, to have somebody who's like choosing those words, I don't know what, I can hardly spell.
There's also a discrepancy, I think, too, in the amount of time the different things take to do. So if you're an artist, that is, and you have a book, that is your full-time job to try and get something else on the side where you're also writing. It's just like, you don't have time for that.
My problem with writing that I have.
And writers.
is that I do have a story that I want to tell. But the thing is if I tell the story by myself, it's going to be so fast because I'll just draw the scenes because I'm like, I want to do this. I want this guy to be doing this and then this and this. And it's going to be a silent book and people are going to be done in like 4 minutes.
Yeah.
I guess I need words to slow people down, but I don't know what words to put in, but I do know how to tell a story. Mm-hmm. Like I have a story that I want to tell. I just, I've seen people read my comics. And they're done. And like you watch it. Yeah, I just sit there. And they're done. Yeah. Because I feel bad because they've just spent however money and they've only walked 4 feet from the table.
Yeah.
And then like, he gets to the end and he's like, oh, I just spent $5 on this and I'm done. Yeah. And like, but that's, for me, it was a big story that I thought, you know, took forever to read, like, you know, like it had something.
Yeah.
But for other people, they're like, you know, they see a guy, see this guy, and then flip to the end, and I had like 4 lines of dialogue throughout the whole thing, and you know, that's the end of their experience, and I'm like, I have to bring more somehow. And
I have to keep doing that, like yeah. That thing you do with Jeremy, that silent book,
Pulp,
yeah, it was awesome, right? But I don't know how you could keep that up every month, like to just keep going. People would be like, done.
You just have to be able to draw it in 5 days.
I had someone text me last week, and they're like, cool, I'm just sitting down to read your comic, and they texted me like 3 minutes later, and they're like, that was really cool.
I feel like typing. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, because Scott, I know you brought this up on the podcast before, about like how when you were viewing a book, that it actually took you some time to read, and to kind of get through, and how that is a skill unto itself, but like the problem is there, like, where is that balance of like, this is enough words for you to read, and this is way too many damn words, and George you're Perez, actually yeah. just describing the artwork.
I don't have an answer for that.
what's a comfortable read? Like, I know I've read books that, like, I don't know why I'm still reading this book. Why is it continuing to go on?
Darwin Cook's The Spirit, I thought, was a really comfortable read where there was a lot of dialogue, but there was also a lot of panels and a lot of action.
Mm-hmm. And lots happened. Stories every issue.
One story every issue. Like, I'm not terribly fond of the drawn-out stories, like the, you know, Mysterious Strangers teardrop. When it was going was, you know, a story every 2 issues, which was the format that I was really attracted to, because that, to me, is enough story to then say, okay, done, move on to the next.
It was really satisfying to read.
Thanks.
It was really, yeah.
I'm glad I satisfied you.
I got that.
Never fails, my man. Never fails.
Isn't that sort of addressing them, like, decompression? They're both like ready.
I don't scuba dive.
Well, like,
so lame.
I feel like Warren Ellis.
So you're floundering a little bit.
Oh,
that was amazing.
You're in deep water now.
So that if you're a writer and you're independently trying to produce something, though, you have to find an artist.
Yes.
What's the challenge in that? How does that go about?
It's hard to find an artist that I think it's important to, unless you're doing little 5-page stories, it's important to find artists that that you get something from, and you kind of collaborate together. I don't much like the idea of just work for hire stuff. But on the same note, I think it's important that people fucking pay the artists as well.
Yeah.
So
I disagree.
Fight.
Seriously, I do.
Sure, no, yeah.
Because I think that as an artist, if I'm invested in it, because when I first started, before I had like an OGN note or anything, this guy paid me like a page rate to do a pitch. And I finished the pitch, and then it was just kind of weird, because if we sold it, I get paid. Mm-hmm. And he, like, you're a team. If I'm invested in the work, we're partners, I should it's a commitment together.
Sure.
Yeah, okay. I think it doesn't bother you though, the discrepancy in the commitment to the piece.
I mean, maybe work that out on the back end, like the time thing or whatever. Yeah. But I'm totally. I think your partner's kind of, you're going into it together. If I'm putting like, if I like your idea enough to do it, mm-hmm. let's do it. I know most people wouldn't agree with that.
I've done that before too.
We talked about that before, and I was like, I wouldn't want to pay that. I just take that money.
There have been projects that, like, when people bring them up to you, and somebody suggested, there was one where I was like, I'll work on with you, and we'll just divvy up things on the back end a little differently, but I'll do it free. But most of the time, I can't get into the idea of that. I've turned down a lot of people that have wanted to do the free stuff. And I think it's what you're saying, the investment in the work, because I have my own stories that I want to tell generally. Yeah. So if you want me to work on that story, to invest in, it's going to take something else.
One thing that's interesting, sorry to jump in, is that so with Fight Comics Volume 1, I didn't have a lot of money, but I did pay each of the artists to do work on it. With Fight Comics Volume 2, most of those stories were actually stories that were pitched to me by artists. In fact, Nick and Ben here both have stories in Fight Comics Volume 2 that they brought to me as ideas. And so for me, on this, we're not doing a page rate. I'm not paying a page rate because it's our story. Yeah. It's literally.
There's also the you, Jason, bit to that as well, though.
How do you mean?
Yeah, if you're good friends.
Yeah, if another guy was like, well, I want you to come up with this story, I'll do the script, and then, it's going to be, I would hesitate still.
So, definitely with that. Yeah.
Who owns the IP then?
For ours, I would assume both of us.
Yeah.
You pay an artist to do something, right?
Yeah.
Because that's the other flip side of that is that I feel like if I'm getting a page rate, the writer's working for free,
right?
Then they own that piece.
That's what I feel too. You've been paid to do the work.
Right. Then you're just doing work, right?
Potential back end.
A lot of this can be, this could be negotiated. It could be I'll pay you the page rate now because I want to respect your time, but I also want the project done in a certain time, because
I think it's every project's different, and with IP, I do contracts up for if I paint like Valentine on Dave's, he's getting paid, right? Just so that we can do it, otherwise it wouldn't have done. But he also has equal split in IP and everything.
Yeah, so. And you could negotiate something where you're like, okay, I'm going to pay you a pay rate, say for the pitch or what have you. But then if we get an advance, then I'll take your page rate out of our advance or to
make sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. The page rates, some of the setups I've seen have done stuff like that where there's an advance that comes out of potential earnings and then divvy up on the back end. But there's also a skew on the divvy up on the back end too that favors artists.
Well, so that's a thing that I think is interesting because, I agree with you. Say if somebody's writing books at Image, right, they can make... Or anyway, yeah. But say you write Jason, you write two Marvel books and a Dark Horse book and three Image books, right?
I'm going like mad.
You're doing good.
Yeah.
An artist that's working on an Image book with you, right? Usually people split stuff 50-50. Mm-hmm. But their artist puts in way more time.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
That's where I see kind of a weird thing. Mm-hmm.
Which is why sort of that bit up front helps offset that. If you do go 50-50 at the end, then that bit of advance on the profit that comes out on top before you split the profits kind of helps balance.
Should
that
profits
out.
On the books be 60-40 or 70-30?
On
and then IP 50-50. There's all different models.
Yeah.
I've seen all different models.
Yeah. I think Busick said he was doing that. He does 60-40 on Astro City. 60-40 the artist's way.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think even when there is the advance to the artist Ryan talks about, I don't think that should be in lieu of appropriate consideration for the writer if the book gets picked up or something that. I think it's just what Jason was saying, sort of respecting the fact that it's gonna take 8 times 6 or 7 days, 8 hours times 6 or 7 times for the artist, whereas the writer is gonna hour and a half.
To get the idea out is that there's also sometimes a writer is looking to create a whole world with an artist, and so then it literally is a creation of the two of them, a riffing back and forth.
Sure.
Yeah. And there's other times where a writer is like, okay, here's the series Bible.
Do it.
So and I'm not saying that answers the question, but just that it maybe points out the complexity of the issue. But
I think it's weird too, or there's a difference if you guys are both like sort of untested or unpublished. Mm-hmm. It feels really bad. Like I only did the one time that this guy, his name was Odie. He would go to work. I know he's like working a shitty job, but he's in an office, and then he's writing me a check, and I'm like, we both don't have anything out.
Yeah.
And it's weird, right? But that's when you're both sort of like prevent professionals, if you both have stuff published, yeah, and somebody sends you something, you're like, oh, that's cool, I'll draw that. And you know it's gonna get published and stuff. It's
sure.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I just do it.
It's that certainty of knowing if it's going to be published. Yeah. I think that makes the big difference, because you kind of have, you know, you kind of have your people who will always publish Rossmo. And that's kind of it.
Everybody.
But I mean, you know, that's nice to know. Whereas, you know, I can kind of understand those who are just sort of doing it for the first time, not knowing where something will land, going, I actually need some money to make this happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's just, it feels really bad knowing that, like,
yeah,
Ryan's out there, like, you know, pounding nails or something.
Yeah,
that's
what he does. Yeah, no,
and then, like, gets his chest.
I mean, I guess I see it as like skin in the game, because he's spending less time,
yeah,
on the actual,
yeah,
physical time with writing versus the physical time with the drawing. Not to say that the writing's any less important,
sure,
just the actual physical committed time is less. He can do four books.
Yeah.
I can work on one.
Although the interesting thing, sorry, you go ahead.
No, but there, you know, there, I think there's a division of labor, you know, within the creation of a book that, you know, Riley and I would say, you know, spend 8 to 10 hours a day, you know, working. And a writer could potentially be doing that exact same thing if it were a full-time job, you know, between writing and marketing.
Research.
Yeah, research. Because marketing is something that I love to do, but I don't have time. I don't have as much time to do. So I always kind of rely on the writer.
Well, and that's what we did on Proof. Like on Proof, Alex did like all the research. He sent me photos. He sent me reference.
He lettered it.
So then it starts to be more.
Yeah. Yeah. No, with Ryan too, yeah, as a letterer on most of your titles as well, that does sort of even things out for collaboration. The marketing thing is always one of the ones that we have these discussions on Twitter. I love it. Like that's, I want to do a book. I want to be a name for people as well. Like I'm not happy with being like the guy that pushes the pencil and then writer gets to be the face of our title. But like you said, if you're doing 8 to 10 hours a day, you don't have time to do that stuff. But it's not because you don't want to, so I don't really consider it like the writer doing me a favor by going out there and being our face of our project.
But you do benefit from it, right? Like, you do benefit from that writer.
Financially, yeah.
Yeah.
So well, but point. I mean, the other thing too is that it's not like, it depends on, like, in the hypothetical situation that the writer is doing that business work of writing, of like, not the creation, but the rest of it, like, that, you know, if you've got a good collaborator, then he is pushing both of your faces. It's not.
That's a good point.
You know, like he's not saying,
very true,
hey, look at me and my book. We have to be drawn by some guy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then you get a check. It's like, it's da da together, you know, or whatever. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's where I think, you know.
At last.
I was just imagining the words flying through.
Mammal Johnson. Word art.
That's where being invested in it together from the outset is really important, because, you know, I've done, you know, pitches and projects that I wasn't totally invested in, mm-hmm, and they didn't go anywhere. And, you know, having that investment, you know, with another team member, with, you know, basically a coworker, becomes that much more important, because then you're kind of in it with a friend, which I think is kind of cool.
And it's really important. That's the difference between, maybe that's the difference. Maybe if you have that relationship and somebody's mm-hmm like, I know you need to work on this, so I'll pay you.
Yeah.
If you're close or whatever, maybe, like, I could see that working. It's just when it's like just somebody off the internet.
Oh, yeah.
They
got
an email from some guys that were like, oh, we met you at New York Comic Con and we want to pay you this much or a page to do this movie, this thing for a movie that we're making. Maybe.
Yeah.
Anyway, I wasn't there, so. Like that's a lot different than somebody you like that's like, I understand this is going to take 2 months. I need to pay you. Something maybe like
no
that starts to make
it's
sense,
not a one
right?
size
yeah.
it's all sort of answer to this stuff when you drill down into it, but yeah,
for me it's been kind of like I've built up all these short comics, 5-6 pages, maybe 8 pages, and those were very much work for hire, like, hey, you're a good artist and you'd be a great fit for the story, so like,
that
hey, you did it.
What you
and there's just really tiny little stories, but then for like the bigger things that I've done, it's always been like, okay, like, we're both super invested in this. We both get along. We work great. We collaborate great together. So it's like, I'm willing to make that financial sacrifice so that we can both do this.
And you can survive what you're doing your part.
Yeah, and I've worked with artists that were like, no, let's not. Let's just do it together.
So then how do you monetize that?
We originally did that. I just hate you anyways.
Sorry? Well, like, how do you monetize if you're a writer then and you have the concept? Like, how do you, like, you need to make the money to pay the, do you just save up a big batch of money?
Well, yeah, you don't.
You go to your goddamn nightmare fucking day job, yeah. And you suck the man's dick for hours, and then you go home and you work
right for part
X amount of time.
You do another part-time job.
Ryan and I had different jobs, just so
just to be clear. Sorry. That was the metaphorical.
I didn't get paid for that.
The figurative dick.
Just gotta know where
you're underpaid.
I think it's good if you can do something industry related. Like, yeah. Ed, I think he, this is how it got started. Ed Brisson self-published and stuff for a while, but he doesn't translate. He has letters manga.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
He's still working in comics.
Yeah.
So he got working in like writing.
Yeah, and I think he's just made the switch over to full-time comic writing, right?
Yeah.
That's what I've been doing. I've been lettering.
That's his day job, sorry, not full-time. He still does lettering. Yeah.
Right? Most of my weeks are, I letter 3 to 1. You know, in terms of writing, yeah. It's all the if I break in into like hire bigger publishers, it'll be because of the lettering.
Now, one thing though, I mean, you have Dave out there, the artist on that. What's his name?
Valentin Ramon.
So if he leaves that book, though, you can find the artist, and that book will keep going. Correct.
No, in the case of Dave, if he didn't want to do Dave or continue doing it, then we wouldn't do it.
Because you do see that. I mean, an artist can't, even an independent book, artist can leave.
Dave's a 5-issue mini, though, and we're almost done it. So. But in the case of Dave, I couldn't see.
Yeah, but we talked, though, about the split. I mean, theoretically, the book will keep going with the writer.
Yeah.
And not necessarily. I mean, how often do you see the writer leave on an independent book and keep going with the artist and a new writer?
Turtles?
Pardon me?
Yeah. Yeah. Turtles?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's it?
Is that it?
Didn't that happen with Wolverine?
Wolverine?
That new, or no, Sad Wolverine, didn't that happen?
I don't know.
He's like an established character.
He's someone.
Yeah,
he's
that's
an established character. That's a bit.
We're talking about Crate.
Oh, you're talking. Oh, Crate. Oh.
Can you imagine if somebody else picked up Cerebus and started writing and doing that for
him?
Yeah. Some of the Image stuff, but it's, again, it's, the Image stuff is almost like. Like a business owned.
Like the Silvestri kind of?
Yeah, like Silvestri like did it. Or whatever. My friend did it on Spawn.
But that's more, they're more editorial.
Drawing at that point.
Yeah.
They're not really, they're story concerned.
They still control it, yeah.
Yeah. Well, and like when you were saying monetize, I think one of the other interesting questions is like when you're saying how do you monetize even the, so like you save up your money and then you put out a book, you spend the, like you print and you distribute and all that stuff. I don't like. I've put that money to it. I have not yet monetized it in the sense of making a profit, you know. And I think I'm considering this like a maybe a way to think of it would be like a tuition cost or a marketing cost or some kind of like
paying your dues.
Yeah, yeah. Like essentially, you're like if you're looking at this level or in my level, I would say putting that money into it, you cannot be thinking about it like. Like if you're releasing a widget that people will buy a certain amount of, and then you make a profit. Like it's
It's, and I see so much talk going on at like, especially on Twitter, about a lot of super new indie creators are so focused on making money, and it's just like, dude.
Yeah. The word.
No, it's not. You're not.
You were do something else. Do anything else.
Yeah.
If it's about making money, do anything.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I think it's the amount that you're willing to let go of your money. It's like, this is how much money I can throw away and not expect to ever see again.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And that's how I chose my colors.
Is that it?
No, what I'm saying is, I know that go-getters won't make back the amount that I put in color.
You're still
color.
Not making it any better.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So,
are you and Sean splitting the cost in color?
I decided to do it myself. I didn't even really talk to Sean about it. Really, I just said I want to, because he's like, you can color it yourself. I'm like, I'm not that good of a colorist. So I decided on my own just to find a colorist. And so I decided, okay, I have this much money that I'm willing to throw into a volcano and see if the volcano explodes or not.
No, so I'm okay with this scenario.
No, but what I'm saying is,
the volcano jumps.
I'll never.
Is it like a magical wish volcano? Like, give me a colorist.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. You're saying this is a loss.
I'm saying. I know it's not like it's not an invest. It is an investment, for sure. But at the same time,
it's an investment on your future as opposed to an immediate return on the sale.
Yeah, no, I definitely do not. I mean, I can't expect go-getters to make, you know, the money back plus dividing in half with Sean and then replenishing my costs for that. I just have to basically go, okay, this is what I can throw down.
So how about kind of based on that idea, how about the idea of what we've seen as a trend of people breaking into industry with an independent book to try and get a job with one of the big two, getting a job with one of the big two, making a better, bigger name for themselves so they can go back to the independent books and have higher sales.
It's just the cycle of life.
It's just what they want to write, really. Like,
is that seems to be a trend that we've seen a lot. Will that continue? Yeah. Is that a good thing?
I think it's a great thing.
That's my new dream. Yeah. It used to be just work for Marvel. But now I feel like the back door is the indie stuff, and then they come to you and say, hey, try working on Spider-Man for a bit, and then you do that, and then you go back and do your own shit.
You've seen it with Hickman, a writer.
Sure.
Brubaker.
Math Fraction.
You've also seen it, though, with artists.
Math.
Well.
Math Fraction. Sorry.
Yes, thank you.
Math Fraction.
Why does he go by that? How does he not go by Matt? How do you do that to everybody else that have to look at your name and say, if he just changed one letter, he would be the greatest pun
ever. Actually, is
it? I'm sure he's never heard it before.
Is, sure
you're exactly. His name is Matthew. It's not that big of a stretch.
Yeah, he hears this.
There's no reason you will, but if, please.
All the books from now on is Matt.
I texted Ryan about this like 2 weeks ago, and he gave me the most insincere response ever. He's just like, why'd you fucking text me? I was busy jerking off to my sigil and you interrupted.
Yeah, and it didn't work. You fucked up my flow, dude.
Now I gotta do it again.
It was that dip in stamina that
you
caused
that
the sigil to backfire.
Oh, you got me off my dick for this?
Just to bring this back around.
Okay. But that's what started, what Image was, is people followed the creator. Because before, the ideology was people followed the
character.
The character.
Yeah.
And, I mean, there still is that sense. But there's more of a sense also that people follow a creator now. They'll follow a creator, what a creator will do. So if
actually, and you say Image, but I mean, I think you started to see that with some before Image, with you know, Frank Miller. Mm-hmm. And people started to follow him, right? Before
Image
came around.
Yeah, he went to DC and then to do his own and all that sort of stuff. So that was the.
Now, how about if you're breaking into the industry, talking about it? How about the advantage or disadvantage day? What is it? Is it better as an artist to have that style that's unique and that's your own, or to have that style that fits into what Marvel and DC historically like?
Depends on what you want to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I kind of feel like it's out of my control at this point.
Your name on the top of the book, or do you want to be, you know, artist number 3 on Amazing Spider-Man?
It is possible to get in there when you have a unique style and do it below the top two, but it's more difficult.
You usually get the one-off story.
I've got both the things I've done for the big two with their backing or whatever stuff. They hired me to do what I do, which is really cool. They're just like, do this as fucked as you want. I was like, really? And then they had to get it colored and they're like, colors doesn't know how to color. Can you color it too? I'm like, sure, right? But then what book do you put somebody like that on, right? Like,
it's got to be like a standalone, right?
Or like Moon Knight.
Yeah.
I think if they did it, or Elektra Assassin or something.
Or even, I guess Hawkeye. There's a couple. If you can do those standalone storybooks.
But if you have too unique of a style, it's hard to use in the big two. And plus, it makes fans really mad.
Mm.
Like my Superman story, people were like...
It'll look weird in the trade paperback. Like,
yeah.
I mean, if it's a crossover heavy book.
But that was even though on their like digital first 12-page stories, and fans were like, this guy sure doesn't know how to draw Superman.
Yeah, and they make it sound as a disadvantage having a unique style.
Well, depending on who you're going for.
But it depends what you like. I mean,
it depends on what you define. Like, no. It depends on what you define as a unique style, too. Like,
I mean, I think Scott has a unique style that's interesting because it could work for a big two and work for
Daredevil,
you know?
Yeah. Yeah, they put him on something like Daredevil or Hawkeye or
one of the All Ages books. Yeah.
All Red has the same type of thing.
This is awesome. Let's just keep talking.
Way. Like, I'm comparing you to All Red.
Not that good.
But no, I mean, I think there is something to that.
I want to be a writer.
I'd say Marvel's a little bit more. It seems a little bit more open right nowadays than than people think of it as a house style.
Yeah. Other than Riley or some pieces, I think DC is still a little bit tighter on their Jim Lee.
I keep doing style. Swamp Thing pieces, and they don't care.
Because
come on,
they're I think I honestly think there's an executive decision in there going this is what works, so we want to stick with this.
And you notice like where they do divert, like when Animal Man came for the new.
Animal Man.
What is Animal Man?
Animal Man.
I'm sorry.
No.
Animal Man's at the back end.
Animal Man. Like Animal Man was a pretty unique, almost a one-off in its own way. So they were able to. What's that name?
Travel Foreman.
Travel Foreman.
Love Travel Foreman.
He's beautiful, crazy, unique stuff. But you open up a DC book and see that, and you're like, "Holy crap! I can't believe he got away with this." Mm-hmm. Like he pulled.
Where's the lines on his suit? Where's the collar?
Yeah, why isn't everything outlined specifically? I can't look at backgrounds unless they're outlined.
Even Vertigo stuff is like that now. Like it, and that's sad to me because you used to have like Sam Keith and I'm trying to think who else started on that book. John Snyder?
What was that?
Like everything about creating Vertigo used to be like, you do something
John
expressive.
Bolden, you mean, or?
John Bolden. But they'd start you in there if you're super expressive, and then if you serve like Chris Bacello, they'd move you over to something more.
Yeah.
I guess he defected to Marvel. Stuff like that.
There was that Book of Magic, like the first Book of Magic that Neil Gaiman put out. It had like each issue was a different artist.
Oh yeah, Charles Vest did one.
Yeah, Charles Vest. But there was also like that last issue was full of, like it was a painted but like crazy expressive stuff. And, you know, I can't remember the name of the artist right now. But yeah.
Well, who did the work on that? On that at least the first run anyways for Batwoman when the new 52 came out.
J.H. Williams.
Those are. Yeah, he was up on it until the last couple months.
Everybody should just. I'm just saying this. This is just a blanket statement. Marvel Knight Spider-Man, Marco Strudi.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, shit.
Oh, really?
Just pick it up. It pertains to the art. It's made.
It's like a Vertigo Spider-Man.
Really?
Ooh. It's people that compare it to J.H. Williams. It's like J.H. Williams, but just mental. Oh, it's so good. And all story specific. Yeah.
Yep.
It's amazing. The first issue has like Nintendo 8-bit graphics in it.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
That's amazing.
It's painted. And
I like all the storylines. The art was amazing.
I get annoyed when you get the standard sort of events, DC Marvel fan guys that are just like, this isn't that usual style that I've been seeing for the last 20 years, and like, I can't handle art, and get really angry.
It's weird though, because if you do that enough, sort of like, what's the Spider-Man guy named? Ramos, right?
Mm-hmm.
When he first started the Spider-Man, lots of people were like, Aunt May looks like a kid, and stuff like that, right?
Yeah, they hear.
And now people are clamoring for it. Like, if he does it, they would call it awesome.
So you just gotta stick it out.
But he's super fast. So.
It's the thing that irks me specifically is Aha on Hawkeye. How all these like regular sort of comic reader guys are like, he's terrible. He's fucking off. I'm like, do you not actually understand what he's doing?
Yeah.
Like, he clearly understands how to draw and how to set up a story and how to tell a story in panel form. Like,
in the most interesting way possible. Yeah. Not just telling in panels, but like, and now I'm going to have
using negative space,
bar graph,
black areas.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. Get iconographic with it.
Having an editor and a writer that understands how to use an artist like that and present a project to them, that was important too.
Mm-hmm. I'd love to know that one issue of Hawkeye with Pizza Dog, how that was, like, how much of that was scripted and how much of it was, like, was Aya coming up with it, like
How do you even script that though? Like, I was looking at it, going, like, that seems like an artist just going crazy with.
Yeah, well, but on the other hand, like, I totally can imagine Matt Fraction staring at his dog, just kind of being like, "What are you thinking about?"
Yeah, well, I mean, from what I've heard from like Matt Fraction interviews, is that he's pretty
invested. Or
yeah, he's or rather, he puts a lot of it's very. Very collaborative.
Detailed.
He puts a lot of
input.
They both.
I want to know what they sent to editorial, though.
Yeah. Like you're saying, putting the right people in the same book. Like, what does that script look like? Mm-hmm. Like, so there's a dog, and there's all these icons, and then Smell's a bad guy.
Yeah.
How do you like
anybody else? They're just like, fuck off.
Well, and yeah, at a certain point, as a writer, can you, or as an artist, can you just get to a point where it's just like, it's about my dog. That's it.
Faction, I guess.
Yeah, certain writers.
Except for, like,
I don't think an artist could be like, I'm doing this next issue entirely in watercolor. Without lines. Just going to be impressionist.
Just with my thumb.
Just with my thumb. Oh, yeah, I'm going to do thummies.
That brings up a thing that I always get kind of frustrated about, because people that are popular are allowed to get away with stuff that people that are unpopular, like, that aren't, you know. For example, me doing something in even Grindhouse, which was his sub low book.
I don't know what that means, but that sounds derogatory.
But
you mean subnormal?
But basically, they wouldn't let me get away with stuff that I know person A would have been away with.
Right.
Like someone who's very popular draws a page, and I honestly sometimes see some terrible stuff because they're a popular person.
They know, hey, you need to redraw that.
Yeah.
So is laziness are you talking, or just weird? Like Jim Lee All-Star Batman spread? Like just...
No. I mean like, is like, I think I pretty much did this in like...
2 seconds?
A day.
Okay.
This whole book. Type of thing.
Loose and sloppy.
Loose and sloppy, and then like, you know, like...
Wait, what are we talking about?
I zoned out for a second.
Back on topic, Jim.
But
let's pick it up from loose and sloppy.
They're getting paid 3 times as much as I am.
Right, yeah.
And they're like, this is amazing! And then they just like throw it out there, and everyone's like, this is amazing! And then everyone is amazed by it.
Mm-hmm.
Me, I'm being told to redraw something 3 times. And I'm like... But look at this guy that you're paying twice as much for. But
Did you get more of that at the beginning? Or have you ever really had that kind of throwback on your
stuff? No, I found out that Proof almost got canceled a couple times after I did the art, but nobody told me. Because it's the creator-owned book, they can't really fire it because of the art.
I have a hard time believing that, because, I mean,
yeah, I love that
book I fell in love with. It was... after it was published, of course, so I wasn't buying month to month, so, you know.
So it's your fault.
Yes. The art and the writing were matched perfectly on that book. Like, how could you complain about that? And
I don't know. After the fact, I don't know. But Marvel made me redraw some stuff, but it's mostly story stuff.
Oh.
That, like, I wonder, though, if you command enough authority. Yeah.
I honestly have no, like, that's what I mean, like, even with writers, like, you know, some writers will look at the writing and go, this is pretty terrible writing.
Well, superhero book.
Guys, I'm right here, come on.
because they're such a popular writer, no, people don't question it. It's like telling Zack Snyder, no, you don't need to do this in...
14 issues?
No, I'm the other Zack Snyder that makes.
Oh, movies. Sorry, I was thinking of Scott.
The other Snyder.
Decompression.
Sorry. You know, no one was telling him to stop doing the stuff in Sucker Punch, right? Like, say, okay, like, look, you can do this, but come on, slow down with this stuff. And no one did it because everyone was like, "Oh, it's Zack Snyder, and he's just doing what he wants," right? So. And that's why, you know, and then you have people saying that that's the terrible movie or whatever, everything.
Or it's like, and people have said that about Jeff Johns, or like Snyder, or the right Snyder. Scott Snyder.
That's like, the right one.
We've seen people go crazy on Twitter for a book or a creator before the book's even come out, expecting it to be good. And then when it comes out, they give the opinion that it's good, almost like they don't want to be wrong. They don't want to admit that the book wasn't that good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because these writers now establish a certain reputation that they're the hit thing.
It was kind of like a rock star
mythos
around it. And
you do become a commodity at some point, if that commodity is.
But is it your work or is it the person? Because I think there's some creators with like really big personalities. People start to buy their stuff for the...
Well...
I mean, there's the creator, you buy it, you go to Zack Snyder because you like seeing like awesome explosions in slow motion. Right? Or do you go because it's a Zack Snyder movie? Like an Alan Moore thing. Do you go because Alan Moore's really smart? Or do you go because You like beard.
You know what? I know that there's books I've read by somebody who's worked at, you know, a major publisher. They do an independent book, and sometimes it's better and sometimes it's not. And sometimes you go, you know what? The editor really helps that person.
Yeah, because writing... Sorry.
Go ahead. No bad. Please.
I was going to say, like, superhero books are a particular thing. Being good at writing a superhero book is not necessarily, in my opinion, going to translate into you can actually write a good story outside of that kind of microcosm. World.
Even the particular book.
Right? Yeah.
Like, I really like Snyder's Batman is decompressed, and I like it. And the Swamp Thing is decompressed, and I like the ideas, but I thought it was long.
It was long, yeah.
But just because I like them, it doesn't mean I'm like, gonna like all the stuff. But there's a cult of like Twitter and Facebook that then you're buying it, like, everybody follows it because of the creator, but you follow it because of the creator instead of the creator's work.
Sure.
And it starts, that line starts to blur.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
I think, unfortunately, we have to wrap it up. So what we're going to do is going to give everybody a chance. We talk plug. Plug your shit, gentlemen. Going through, we don't need to plug ourselves when we talk.
I'd like to see that.
And I don't care what, I'm studying, and we're going to do a letter writing campaign, all of us in this room. We're going to try and get you to do at least one issue of Batman 66. Because you got to... How good a fit would that be?
You'd read that one, right, Scott?
I do. I pick it up. I like Jonathan's artwork a lot.
I mean, if you drew it, you'd read it.
Oh, if I drew it, I'd read it. Yeah. Well, even
then. All right, Nick.
Yeah. Okay. I guess I've had a webcomic called Wolf Hands with Justin Heggs, which is on a break right now. We'll have a holiday special in season 2 starting in the new year. And then I'm working as a colorist on a book with Chris Peterson called Go Getters.
Who?
Some schmuck in a cool hat.
At least my hat's cool. Jason.
Yeah.
Got nothing. Sorry.
No hat.
Mr. No hat.
And I've been doing some kids' books as well, like e-books on stuff. So if you go to Ankle Biter Publishing and you like kids books for the little ones, I've been doing a lot of work with them, so yeah, you check that out.
I've got...
You Dave. Are Ryan Barrett.
Yes, I am. And, Dave's going to be coming out for the next while. Issue 2's in a couple weeks. Other than that, what else? Tiger Lord 4 is coming out in the spring.
Where can you get Tiger
Lord? Tiger who's a lawyer, right?
Yes. Sometimes. You can get that if you go to readchallenger.com.
Great idea.
You can find a bunch of self-published work for myself, but also other people.
Trade paperbacks like Bloody Fucking Revenge?
Yep. And there's tons of people, a lot of talented people putting up their self-published work through that website, too. So, yeah.
So there was Grindhouse, which has passed, and it's on to its other story. It was put to rest. No, it's still ongoing, but I'm not a part of it. But it's still awesome, and there might be something in the future with it, depending on what happens with it. Because we quasi planned a sequel with Garcia. Other than that, we had Ultra Nova, but that was quite a while ago.
Yeah, that was last year, though, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Cool news.
This year. Yeah, it was this year. But so, yeah, it was like March.
You know what? I fucking love that.
let's see. Pulp was a big thing for us getting done, me and Jeremy Holt. We've gotten lots of critical acclaim for it. But no one buys it.
You might have an Oscar nomination. That's how critically acclaimed it is.
Yeah, you're up for Best Picture.
I bought it. I liked it.
There we go. We're done. So we're hoping to get it going further. I think right now it's just because people are really interested in buying indie books non-digitally. Other than that, working on Go-Getters. I've got another FUBAR comic coming in, Free Comic Book Day. I've got another Monkey Brain comic that I'm in, doing pages here and there for it, type of thing.
How great is Monkey Brain for Lost?
They're great.
Awesome.
They're great.
They're good. They've closed off. everything, so you can't get...
How great was Monkey
Brain?
what do you mean? Is Monkey Brain shut down?
No, they're inundated with submissions.
No more submissions for a while.
Yeah,
as I understand.
I think a lot of publishers are like that right now. A lot of the indie publishers have just been so overwhelmed.
Yeah.
And other random things coming out, but we're hoping Go-Getters is one of our decently big ones coming.
So, Mysterious Strangers, The Trade, comes out January 29th. So, if it's bought enough, who knows, maybe we can revisit it. But Downset Fight, February 12th, from Oni Press, that's an OGN. There might be some news on that one coming earlier. And then, I hope some announcements before middle of the year.
I love it.
I'm doing some Valiant covers and stuff for Valiant, those guys.
It's pretty fun.
I like working for them. And some covers for Boom and a new werewolf book that I'm a co-creator of called Curse. I'm doing covers and a few interior pages, flashbacks, and my ongoing Drumhowler from Image Comics. It's on issue 3. It's a psychedelic adventure. A cat. The ghost cat. That's it.
It's just a cool, cool one.
Yeah.
John Deadman right now, just for myself.
So I've got Fight Comics, Fight Comics Volume 1, which some of the people at the table here worked on. Ryan did some of the lettering, and Nick Johnson did one of the stories there, and that's actually, you can find that on fightcomics.ca.
Look at that, the letterer got top bill on that one.
Well, hey, it reads so cleanly, so it's, yeah, good one. Anyway, fightcomics.ca, that's volume 1. Volume 2 is in the works, maybe hopefully ready by March. We'll see how that goes, and yeah, that's it for me.
The only thing I can really say is, well, I guess working with Jason, going to do a Fight Comic story, so probably March. Something that you'll see in January is I'm illustrating an album, just kind of cool, one-page, a song thing that I'm doing for this local band called Sydney York Pop Band. So that'll be out starting in January. They're going to do this cool submission thing where you basically get a subscription to their album. They release 2 songs every couple months, and then there's a cool one-page narrative that I'm doing that'll go with each of those songs. So that's kind of been fun to work on, and then I've got something else that I'd like to hopefully... It's exciting for me, because it would be the first big piece of what that I'm going to do, but it's not final, so what are you going to do? Can't say anything about it yet.
I hope you come on and talk to us about it when it's about to go.
No!
I hope all of you will come back and talk to us in the future. You all were awesome. Thank you very much for this event. It has been terrific.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks
for the sausage.
Wink.
and the mandarin.
Really good.
Yeah. Thank you all.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Okay. This is all for.
Why are we clapping?
Aggressively, we all defend the role we play. Regrettably, times come to send you on your way. We've seen it all, bonfires of trust, flash floods of pain. It doesn't really matter, don't you worry, it'll all work out. No, it doesn't even matter, don't you worry, that ain't what it's all about. We hope.